I can be a winning Ryder Cup captain away, so it is an exceptionally big deal, and it adds a lot to my legacy.
For the best Ryder Cup build-up reaction and exclusive interviews, go to otbsports.com/golfweekly and become an official friend of the pod now.
OTB AM with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.
Right, you're very welcome along. It's Monday morning and we are bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. Nathan is here, the hardest working man in show business, because Owen's been off hunting Leo Messi.
Wow. We're not at our power rankings yet, but Owen Sheehan should most definitely be in the red. You go all the way to Paris. His first holiday. His first time out of Ireland in, what, 2 years? He's a young guy. He wants to see the world. He wants to see what's on offer in other places. Goes to Paris. He's always dreamed of going to Paris.
Yeah.
The romance of it all. To the Arc de Triomphe, which it turns out has been covered completely for some art installation. So you can't even see the Arc de Triomphe. So you say, at least all right, I can't see one wonder of the world.
That's an experience though, right? You know, that's a, so something's going to have to make up for this.
You go and you pay for your incredibly expensive tickets at the Parc de Princes to go and see the greatest club side in the world, featuring the greatest player of all time. Probably the first time Owen Sheehan has ever seen Lionel Messi in the flesh. And then Messi doesn't really do anything for the 75 minutes he's on the pitch.
He gets hiked off.
Hiked off. And yeah, Owen Sheehan. The Instagram post stopped, I noticed that pretty quickly.
They don't serve any booze in the stadiums. Or maybe they do in Paris. Maybe it's different because the French expect that the people who are coming to the games will be able to, I don't know, hold their liquor. Maybe they don't. I don't know. If you have anything that you want us to put in the performance rankings, now would be a good time to get involved in the show. We're going to be giving away a Gillette starter pack a little bit later on in the show for anybody who enters the competition. You can do that by text 0879 180 180, or of course you can leave a comment in the YouTube stream. You can DM us on Twitter at OffTheBallAM. OTBAM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. We've got a very busy show. We're going to tell you what's coming up. I'm going to kick this off straight away with the performance rankings. David Myler is going to join us at 8:05 to look back on a pretty interesting weekend of Premier League activity that has essentially made everybody feel exactly the same way they felt before kickoff about most things. Sports pages at 8:30, Ryder Cup preview. We're talking about the adventures of Team OTB. We're doing a duathlon in Punchestown. The time is ticking. It's about 2.5 weeks away at this stage and we're not ready for it. That's all part of our explanation of why you should all be wearing Whoops. John Giles is going to join us around about 9 o'clock to talk to us about Jimmy Greaves, and Karen Duggan is going to join us to talk about Ireland-Australia tomorrow in football, as Vera Powell looks for a win. Any kind of win at this stage would do her. Although it turns out Australia are pretty good at football as well, so that's probably not going to happen. 33 minutes past 7, time for us to get into this week's performance rankings.
You know, that wasn't an All-Ireland winning performance.
Probably should have won the game based on the second half performance.
Is it a step too far to say it was the performance so far of the World Cup? Maybe not.
OTBAM's performance rankings with Gillette.
I'm scratching my head. The performances was just lacked that intensity.
So normally Owen does this, Nathan, and he explains how it works and everybody. It's very seamless. There's a lot of pressure. These are big shoes you have to fill today, especially because he's off swanning around France.
Well, Jer, as you'll know from the performance every week, performance rankings every week, Jer, it's a slow start to this, isn't it? 2 in red, which means not very good. 1 in amber, which means, yeah, a bit grand. And 2 in green, which means a
big thumbs up for that. How do we come up with the colours, Nathan?
I don't know. It's like some sort of traffic light system or something.
There you go.
Miraculous. Let's start with the red then. We didn't put Owen Sheehan in, but we did put the Messi Paris Saint-Germain project. So they're playing Lyon last night, go 1-0 down. They look for inspiration, and there's not much inspiration coming. Neymar equalises from the penalty spot, and then Mauricio Pochettino probably takes the biggest risk of his entire career. Bigger risk even than starting Harry Kane in the Champions League final. He takes Lionel Messi off with 15 minutes to go, says, actually, I'm not going to take and use the greatest player of all time to try and win me this game. You can't do that, Lionel. I'm going to bring on Hakimi. Change my system, and lo and behold, it all works out. And Mauro Icardi, still there, Paris Saint-Germain, pops up, pretty much last kick of the game, 93rd minute, and wins it for Paris Saint-Germain. So he has won the battle, I guess, there with Gio Pochettino, because they won the match. But in taking Lionel Messi off, has he ultimately lost the war?
Did he lose the war? This is the $64 million question, right? So if you're Pochettino and you're out of work and Paris Saint-Germain ring, you're taking that phone call and you're going, yeah, of course I'm going to take that job because it's one of the best jobs in world football, right? Or is it? I mean, if you look now at how well Thomas Tuchel is doing at Chelsea and you compare with the perceived failure that Tuchel had at Paris Saint-Germain to get the most out of his available resources, you begin to wonder if this is actually one of the most poisoned chalices that anybody can ever have. It's like,
is it a no-lose situation?
Is it though? Like, I mean, okay, so
Thomas Tuchel is at Chelsea despite all that happened to Paris Saint-Germain. He still managed to emerge with credit in the bank, and Mauricio Pochettino has the most devastating attacking force we have ever seen in world football at his disposal, until January at least. You go, you win the Champions League, you're the guy who could somehow knit all this together. You're the next Carlo Ancelotti. You know how to get all the Galacticos working together, and that's you as a manager for the next 20 years.
Maybe. That's assuming they win the Champions League, which is a massive if, right? Because there's a possibility that this isn't actually all going to work out the way it works out in FIFA. That they don't have a midfield. That this is Manchester United. The criticism of Manchester United that everybody has, midfield's not going to... And it's like exactly the same problem that they have at Paris Saint-Germain. And you have a striker who's on his way out in Mbappe, who, is he really going to play to his full potential this year, given that there's the risk of injury for a team that you're not going to be with next season, or until they sign a new deal? And maybe they will, actually, because they've said that they're intent on keeping him. So maybe they just give him $2 million a week and he's the first £100 million a year soccer player, basic netto. I don't know. But I don't think there's a guarantee that this is going to work. I think that we've all been shooing them into Champions League favouritism. They were the shortest, them and City were the shortest prices. And things don't work out like that in football. Football's still a team game where you need a team and you need an ethos and you need everybody to work together. And Leo Messi did not look happy. I know you're going to say these are still photographs. So there's the first one. He's like, well, what's going on, right? So
that is the most I've been in Paris 3 weeks and I now have all the Parisian
mannerisms.
Yeah.
It's
he just needed the fingers
it's
together.
It's this one where he's on the bench and it's like everybody's watching him and he knows the whole world is watching him. And he ain't happy. He's not happy because he's getting taken off.
If it wasn't 2 weeks in, you would look at that picture and think, that guy has screwed me. That guy has humiliated me.
Well,
this guy.
I mean, he has though, right?
By Tottenham.
This is Leo Messi.
Mauricio Pochettino says that he's protecting him from future injury. Leo Messi is not a kid anymore. He can't play every single match.
Well, I'm protecting you from, I'm saving you from yourself, Nathan. You just can't handle this. You're not aware enough of everything. Well, then don't pick me in the game.
Well,
give me a rest. Don't make me play this stupid game if you're not going to give me the opportunity. What I was doing was I was showing the centre back one picture for the whole game, and in the last 5 minutes, when he expects me to do that, I'm going to do what I always do and skin in the opposite direction. But you, what kind of footballer were you, Pochettino? Your team's played crap football. Oh, let's push, let's press. Where's the beauty in that? I'm Leo Messi. You're Mauricio Pochettino. You couldn't even manage Harry Kane. And now you're learning the Harry Kane lessons now, are you? Thanks very much.
Well, I think if I'm Mauricio Pochettino, was well able to manage Harry Kane and got the best football of Harry Kane's career out.
But then he picked him in a game he wasn't fit for and lost the opportunity of a lifetime in the Champions League.
Maybe he's learned his lesson.
Well, that's what I'm
saying.
Maybe
he's learned his lesson.
Now you have.
And he says, Lionel Messi, I'm not going to have the same thing, Lionel. I'm going to protect you the way I couldn't protect Harry. So you're there and available. There's no problem with taking Messi off at 15 minutes ago, except that it's 1-1. And you're telling Lionel Messi, I don't believe that you can win us this game.
It's 3-0, you take Messi off.
In the final quarter of an hour.
Yeah.
I'm thinking that me as a coach, tactically, I can make a load of changes, bring on a full-back, change system, and that's going to be a better fit for Paris Saint-Germain than you, the greatest player of all time.
So is that what he did? He changed, he went to a five, did he? What did he do?
No, he brought on Hakimi, who they also spent a lot of money for during the summer. Like, he made a lot of changes. He is resting players. Like, Gini Wijnaldum was on the bench as well. So,
oh yeah, that's the same.
Well, you're going on about no midfield, actually. And here, Ander Herrera, it's not a world-class midfield, but
no,
they're obviously going for a lot of energy in that midfield, and Wijnaldum will
Everton
certainly
cast
provide
off
them.
Provide Man United them cast off Ander Herrera and Liverpool freebie Gini Wijnaldum. Okay, so it's grand, right?
It's fine. But they can do a job, and they will do a job in most games. But
do a job? Leo Messi can do a job in the last 15 minutes against Lyon.
I don't
at home
see a downside for Pochettino that this is some poison chalice, because he will never have a better chance of winning the Champions League. And yes, it'll all come down, and that's the way of the Paris Saint-Germain job, that even if he wins the league, no one will give him any credit for winning the league, because they have to win it. But if they don't win the Champions League, he'll probably get fired.
Nobody's going to turn down the gig. I understand that. Nobody's going to turn down the opportunity because you think that you're going to be the one who's going to be able to do it. What I'm saying is that so far, the jury is out. This was supposed to be a swashbuckling team that was going to slash and burn its way across the mediocre defences of European football. But it turns out that Lyon are able to frustrate them and thwart them for 93 minutes, and that they've already struggled in the league and that they haven't looked amazing so far.
Well, and the Champions League as well on Wednesday night against Club Brugge, it was a very, very dour game, and Messi was peripheral. Like, I couldn't believe watching 15-20 minute spells where he was stuck out in the right wing and they couldn't get him the ball, they couldn't get him involved in the game, just looked a little bit frustrated. So it's very early days. They haven't had much time together. He was away on international duty. There's matches every 3 days. They obviously haven't come up with a system as of yet that works. Now,
do you think you'd maybe like say, what do you want to do here, Lionel? What works for you? You tell us what works for you, and we're going to like craft what you need around you. Because Neymar is happy to subjugate his ego, it turns out, for this one player in the world. Maybe Mbappe's not. Maybe Mbappe's like, I'm the big dog. He's been the big dog since he was 18. He's 22. He's the one who's got the World Cup. Oh, do you like this? Do you like this little medal, Leo? Look, I got a World Cup winner's medal.
You think that's happening? I would like to see that happen. It's been a slow burner. Everybody thought Messi would come in and they would win 7-0 every match, and Harlem Globetrotters football, and this would be the greatest thing we've ever seen. We might even find them likable, despite the way they've gone about everything. That because the football is so good, we'd sort of give them a pass. But it's been dull so far. And those expensive tickets, people don't want dull. Of a Sunday night in Paris.
I wonder how much they were. Do we find out?
You could be going to the Moulin Rouge.
I mean, not if you don't want to get in trouble.
Did you go to the Moulin Rouge?
No, I've never been to the Moulin Rouge. No. Did you?
No. I do remember somebody offered us to bring us to the Moulin Rouge, and we were all set to go. They said, oh, we'll give you the full backstage tour, everything. And then they were like, that's 150 quid. Like, oh, I thought when you offered to bring us to the Moulin Rouge, like it was some sort of a freebie we were getting. So
you're getting a once-in-a-lifetime experience for 150 quid, and we
went to the, what was the pub next door we did the show from on the eve? the Shamrock Bar, was it? Just went there instead for the night, and that was also in many ways a once-in-a-lifetime experience.
Really what happened was you rang home and said, I'm going to the Moulin Rouge, and you were told, no,
don't come
not.
Home.
You're not.
Don't come
you're definitely
tickets because I've looked at tickets for Paris Saint-Germain, because my kids now obviously are massive Paris Saint-Germain fans, and they range from anywhere from 60 quid for not a great seat, even though the Parc de France is quite a small stadium, so it's not like being in the Stade de France and you're a million miles away.
How much? So 60
from 60 to anywhere up to several hundred, depending on what type of ticket you want.
How much do you think it is to go to the Lion King when it's not a school day?
The Lion King, is this on in the Bourgosh Energy Theatre?
It is, yeah. How much do you think that is?
The Lion King. And so at a weekend of it, so you're thinking I'll bring my wife down for a romantic Friday night. You're going to bring the kids.
I mean, that's the whole point. It's a children's movie.
Isn't it? I've been to see it. I've been to see the musical. The musical is, I suppose it is, a children's musical.
Is it not?
Yeah, it is.
Just a waste of money on kids.
I would say you're looking at 100 quid a ticket.
I mean, essentially, it's 80 quid a ticket.
Right.
Family flies 400 quid.
Well,
I mean, we could go to Paris and see Paris.
I believe a child or two at home.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. And did you buy them?
I mean, look.
Ah, sucker.
You do what you're told, right?
Absolute sucker.
You're given one job. You're like, if I do this,
take them out of school for a day. Get them on the cheap.
Well, that's the right thing to do, it turns out. If there's anybody who, because, I mean, obviously. Anyway, look.
Blatant after your.
But it turns out we could have gone to Paris and watched Paris Saint-Germain for the same bloody price.
Yeah. However, you might have had the own cheating experience.
Well, you know, you're one of the million people holding up your phone and going, I was there when the first fractures in the relationship between Leo Messi and Pochettino. So Pochettino, all joking aside, right, is this a very straightforward thing where you take off the world's most famous, most expensive, richest player in a match when it's 1-1? Do you think Leo Messi has not been humiliated by this? Pochettino saying I'm protecting from himself, that's nonsense. Oh, the stats. His sports bra was beep, 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 beep. Oh, he's going to get injured.
I think the photos probably don't do Pochettino any favours. I expect that we will get, in Lionel Messi fashion, the lip reader at some stage as to what the conversation was. Maybe he was asking, what's going on? Why isn't the clicking? Where are the areas, Lionel? I need your expertise. Give me some advice the way Cristiano does with Ole. Stand here beside me. Help bellow instructions the way Cristiano does with Ole. Please do that with me. And Messi's like, nah, you're grand, thanks.
Yeah, I don't think... early signs not great. That's all I'm saying. This is our overreaction Monday. Early signs are not good.
I know, you can't, but Lionel Messi is going to score 25, 30 goals this season, you'd have to imagine still.
Yeah, is he going to be totally motivated? Is this tough love that he needs at this stage of his career where he's won absolutely everything?
Got a lot of games. You got to rest him up. Get him fit for the big matches.
Start him in the game then.
Got Manchester City coming up in a few weeks.
Tell him I'm going to rest you or you're going to play City a half here and a half there.
Yeah, it's the fact that it's 15 minutes left and you're deciding actually there's a better option right here than Lionel Messi.
Yeah, and it's like, it's not Neymar who I've benched. I am humiliating him. I just think it's going to be very interesting. Speaking of Pochettino, let's move on to number four here. Harry Kane. How is Harry Kane getting on at the moment, Nathan? What's the story? He's in the red this week. Why is he in the red?
Well, no goals so far this season for Harry Kane and barely even any attempts. Getting hammered after the match yesterday for really his lack of effort. He was completely out of the game yesterday. He was dropping deep, which we've seen him be so effective with over the last season and his link-up play with Heung-min Son. But then he didn't seem to be able to get back into position when Spurs were on the attack. They played quite well in the first half, Tottenham. They seemed to confuse Chelsea with their tactics. They had chances, half chances, sort of chances actually in games like that you got to take. And then in the second half, he never got a touch of the ball in that second half and couldn't have any influence on the match whatsoever. And you sort of thought when the Manchester City thing didn't happen, like the two options for Harry Kane during the summer were go, sign for Manchester City, win everything, win leagues, win Champions Leagues, or stay at Tottenham and get your statue outside the stadium and probably be guaranteed 20, 25 goals a season because you're going to play every single match. You're not going to be hauled off like the superstars are at the big clubs with 15 minutes to go when the match is 1-1. You're going to play every minute of every single game and you can catch Alan Shearer's record, which we know isn't actually the record because Jimmy Greaves holds the record. But that maybe people will talk about you the way they do about Jimmy Greaves at Tottenham. And actually, none of that has happened. He's come in, he looks a little bit disillusioned. And this could be the worst case scenario for Tottenham, that they've kept Harry Kane, but Harry Kane's attitude is all off. Harry Kane's attitude stinks. And maybe he's not the professional that everybody says Harry Kane most certainly is, that he'll just buckle down, he'll work hard, be there for the team, be the captain, the leader, the legend that Spurs need, but haven't seen any of it so far.
You got the impression that if he was going to go to City, he was going to have to hit the ground running to justify whatever amount of money that was spent on him. But he doesn't look like somebody who has come back having put in a massive shift over the summer to make sure that he's in the peak physical condition. And the other side of this, right, always the talk around Daniel Levy is what a brilliant businessman he is. He always plays hardball. He knows exactly what he wants. He never sells anybody. But when you look back on it, like, that's based on getting as much money as he possibly could for a few central midfielders a long time ago and then Gareth Bale, which is also quite a long time ago. He missed the opportunity to sell Dele Alli for a lot of money at one point. And so Dele Alli's back in the team. I'm not sure how long that's going to last. But now he's missed the opportunity to sell Harry Kane for a massive amount of money to cash in at the absolute peak of the cycle. Is not wanting to sell always the right thing? I mean, John Duggan called it, as a Spurs fan, he wanted to get the money in, get the rebuild going and see what happened. And actually, since he's come back in the team, have they won a game?
I don't think since he started. Obviously they played very well the first three matches of the season. I think he started third game of the
season.
Did he?
Okay.
But maybe they were telling the truth all along for those first couple of matches, that he wasn't fit, that he had taken more time on his holidays than anybody else. Remember, every single other member of the England squad was available for the first those two matches and Harry Kane wasn't. So maybe he thought, I'm going to let off some steam, I'm going to have a proper old holiday here, and isn't in the best physical condition just yet. Like, Harry Kane has always, always scored goals, and you have to assume that this is going to come right. But he's also playing under a different manager who plays a very different way. And watching Spurs watching Spurs since the start of the season, even on the opening day when they beat Manchester City, it did look like a Nuno side. Like, very patient at times, very set system of what they're trying to do. Wolves didn't score a huge amount of goals. They were very reliant on Raul Jimenez to score the goals. And Harry Kane's obviously several steps up on Raul Jimenez, but not creating any chances for him. And you see, we assume so much of Harry Kane because he's the England captain and all that we read about his character.
Non-stop, like, yeah.
But, and I know it's been thrown out lots, but if this was a different player of a different nationality who was acting like this, we would be assuming that it's a complete lack of professionalism.
Oh, yeah.
So
he'd be Luis Suarez. If Luis Suarez had done this, which he could easily have done, right, at one stage or another, he probably has done in his career, he'd be like evil, personified.
And, well, Luis Suarez, remember, stayed for that extra season on the guarantee that he could leave at Liverpool. And it doesn't seem that that's the kind of deal that Harry Kane has. Luis Suarez got that deal and went on to produce one of the great Premier League attacking seasons. Harry Kane, it does seem, is there under duress. Obviously, behind the scenes, it seemed to be incredibly badly managed in that Tottenham went to him with a new contract offer. He was so gung-ho and I'm definitely going to Manchester City. I don't want to talk about your contract offer. Then City move doesn't happen, comes back and says, give me 400 grand a week. And Tottenham are like, nah, we're done. We have you under contract for another 3 years. So his head obviously isn't in a particularly good place. He's put himself out there. He has, I wouldn't say he's humiliated himself in front of the Spurs supporters, but he has, like, told the Tottenham fans, I want out of here.
Yeah.
They're paying again.
He's humiliated.
Bringing it
Spurs
all down
fans.
To ticket prices these days. People are paying a lot of money to go to that Tottenham Hotspur Stadium.
Yeah, the Spurs fans have been humiliated. I don't think ultimately Harry Kane doesn't really care because he's going to be all right. Things worked out. He won a genetic lottery. Whatever that Irish blood is that he has is serving him in good stead. I'm trying to find the there's no think piece criticizing Harry Kane in the papers, in the English papers. I'm like, what's going on?
Well, Keenan Souness went to town on him. After the game last night, for his lack of effort, lack of impact.
I think he's lucky that the timing of the game yesterday has coincided with the passing of Jimmy Greaves, because all of the papers in England are full of Jimmy Greaves recollections and stuff as well. So, okay, we can come back to that. There's going to be plenty of time for us to give out about Harry Kane. The one thing I would say is that he's always been very streaky. There's been streaks where his form has been bad and he no goals.
But he used to score in August. Remember, he never scored in August for years and years and years. Yeah, then so he started scoring in August.
Well, this is his new August, because obviously he was back a little bit late. The other thing is that there's a World Cup on the horizon. It's essentially a year away. This time next year, everybody will be like, oh, who's in your World Cup squad? You know, and everybody has to be in form. And obviously he's going to be in the squad if he's fit, but...
Well, the prize on offer for Harry Kane in 18 months is your Jimmy Greaves and Bobby Moore rolled into one.
Yeah.
You're captaining England to win the World Cup.
Yeah.
Like, that's as big as it gets.
Get it together, Harry Kane.
There is your statue. Amberger, sort of in between, I'm told, is what the amber is. Next week, we're hoping this will be green. They'll definitely be back in the power rankings next week, performance rankings next week. Will they be green or will they be red?
Your performance is a little less powerful. A little too powerful.
It's the Irish rugby team. So they got the job done yesterday, obviously under massive pressure, all the fallout that came with the game and the defeat against Spain, everything that's been going on off the pitch. It doesn't feel as though it's in a particularly good place right now. They're up against Italy, who Fiona Coughlan called earlier in the week, are very inconsistent. They can go and beat some of the best teams in the world and then a week later just don't turn up. But Ireland beat Italy yesterday 15-7 in Parma. Baveen Parsons, absolute superstar. You talk about that Galway blood, even though, you know, she's Tom Parsons' cousin, so we should kind of claim her as Mayo. 7 tries in 13 internationals. It means that Ireland still have a chance of qualifying automatically. Next Saturday is going to be interesting. So Ireland beat Italy 15-7. Scotland were 27-22 winners against Spain. So this is a 4-team tournament.
Quadrangular, our favourite.
So every team has 5 points. And points difference is now all that separates the sides.
Ooh.
Italy plus 17, Ireland plus 7, Spain minus 4, Scotland minus 20. So if the teams finish level in the table at the end of the final games, the result between those teams counts first, which means if Ireland win and Italy win next week, Ireland would qualify. So the team that finished first qualifies automatically.
We play Scotland
for the World Cup. Ireland play Scotland next week. I said results have been really inconsistent because Italy hammered Scotland in the first match, and then Scotland managed to beat Spain.
Who beat us.
So it's been a bit all over the shop so far.
We'll beat Scotland though, right?
So
let's do what we always do here. We'll beat Scotland. Yep. Scotland are chumps.
There's the quote. Yes, Ireland, with the confidence of that, should really go and beat Scotland. So if they win their group, they will qualify automatically for the World Cup. If they come second, they go into a final global qualifier, and the expectation is that whoever the European team is will win that quite comfortably.
Okay, so...
so if Ireland win...
just win next week and...
they, one way or another, you would expect that they will qualify for a World Cup, which is a far, far better position than they were in, obviously, this day last week.
There was a lot of pressure on them because they had to perform if the result on the pitch continued to match the conditions off the field in the Interpros, then the stink around Irish women's rugby was something that the IRFU were going to find very difficult to wash away. But the results are obviously ultimately the thing that they can point to and say, oh, look, we're progressing here. So,
well, it was just a sensational performance in some ways as well. The Kira Griffin tackle to deny the Italians going over for a try where she's just about to pounce, grabs the jersey and swings around, was a key moment in the game. And Bavin Parsons with the second try. She must have skinned about 12 players in that. So there's a bit of form there now, at least, that they can bring into the match next week. So hopefully, in the performance rankings next Monday, Eoin Sheehan will be back. It'll be a professional event, and they'll be in green.
Dig out the Saturday panel. Gavin Cummins gave lots of very interesting stuff to say about the women's rugby team and the treatment of the women's game by the IRFU. You can get that on the OTV Sports app. Number two is the Ryder Cup.
We're almost there. Team Europe, our boys, Team Europe, fly out today. They should be just getting on the plane around about now, heading towards Wisconsin, whistling straight ahead of Friday's start for the Ryder Cup. The build-up is always interesting. It's going to be particularly interesting, I think, over the next few days with every player sits down for a press conference. What will they be asking all the Americans about, I wonder?
Why do you all hate each other?
And Bryson are going to dominate. So the Americans don't all hate each other. And the Ryder Cup's a strange event. I absolutely love the Ryder Cup. Cannot wait for 1 o'clock Friday when the foursomes tee off. It's as good an event for anyone who's been there. It is several steps above anything else in golf. So you've got like an Irish Open and then you go to an Open and it's 20 times bigger. And then you go to a Ryder Cup and it's 20 times bigger again. Like at the Golf Nacional 3 years ago, 5 o'clock in the morning, there's about 30,000 people at the first tee. Everybody ready, everybody making noise. And that sort of pressure is unlike anything else you ever see in golf. I remember Glenn Eagles in the fog, bright and early, first tee, Webb Simpson. I'd say he hit it 150 yards off the tee. Bubba Watson, like, don't you laugh at him. I think it was Justin Rose had a bit of a snigger when he hit his tee shot.
Did he?
And Bubba turns around and says, don't you laugh at him.
Wow.
Like, that is the level of pressure that is there. It's unlike anything these players...
who won that game?
...experience. Presume the Europeans won that match in the end. But poor old Webb. Thought he was going to get in this time. I suspect when Steve Stricker was thinking about his wild cards and Webb was right in the running, maybe that was front and centre in his mind. So, yeah, the Americans, a lot of it will focus on Brooks and Bryson and the fact there's a team, they're never able to come together. Aside from those two, actually, it seems like a real team, a real group of men who can gel quite well together, who are a young, emerging group. On paper, this is the best American team there's ever been. Every single one of them is in the top 21 in the world rankings.
Is that the first time that's happened?
That is as strong, world rankings-wise, as America have ever been.
Okay.
Now, Europe do have the world number one in John Rahm. But you go through that American side and it's just big name after big name after big name. Colin Morikawa, DJ, Bryson DeChambeau, Koepka, Thomas, Cantlay. You're going through the morning foursomes on the Friday and you're wondering, who do you even leave out for the American side? Whereas you compare it to the Europeans, it's a vastly experienced European side. So Lee Westwood is playing in his 11th Ryder Cup, equaling the record. He probably have played more matches than anyone else by the end of this. Sergio Garcia's 10th is the record point scorer. So it's it's sort of a clash of cultures here, and which do you want? And in a Ryder Cup, actually, maybe experience stands for as much.
But at some point, they'll be washed up versus what they were at their peak. And you don't want to be the coach or the manager or the person who's picking the team. And it's like you're picking the outlads on the basis of their reputation.
Well, he's not even doing that. And we had Potter Carrington on Golf Weekly last week, and you know he's talking about the Justin Rose selection, and he said he didn't hear much controversy about it. I didn't see much controversy about it, and in fact there was little or no controversy, and he can't say it publicly, but he must have been disappointed that nobody made a run on this. Like, there's no 2010 Eduardo Molinari wins the final tournament in Scotland before the Ryder Cup at Gleneagles, having already won the Scottish Open, even though he's a rookie, really has no choice but to pick Eduardo Molinari. nobody has done that. Now, COVID has played a big part in that, and the lack of money in some of the events makes it hard for those players to come through to earn enough ranking points, right, to put a little bit of pressure on. And again, that affects probably the world rankings of the two teams as well. But Shane Lowry's had a good season, you know, hasn't had a win, so didn't take it out of Harrington's hands completely. But still, nobody was saying, well, you know, why is he picking a rookie ahead of Justin Rose? Because Justin Rose has done very little. But you look at the PGA Tour this year in 2021, which is where everybody's playing, mm-hmm, pretty much everyone in this team with the exception of Wiesberger. Like, three Europeans have won on the PGA Tour all year. Seamus Power, who, you know, wasn't really in the reckoning, John Rahm, and Rory McIlroy. The Americans have 14 wins, and they've Xander Schauffele, who won the Olympic gold medal as
Phil
well.
Nicholson.
So, like, they've an absolutely star-studded team, and they have a lot of players who look like they'd be very comfortable playing together. Harrington said he has a theme for the week. He wouldn't tell us what it is. But from reading between the lines, listening to him, like, it is that underdog status that everything is going to be about. We are being written off by absolutely everybody. Like, this will be a big achievement
for
Harrington.
They said we couldn't. They said we shouldn't. So America 15-8 on to lift the trophy, and Europe 11-8 to lift the trophy, 15-8 to win it, 11-1 the tie. Yeah, good chances of tie, no?
Yeah, like, Europe won convincingly last time out. In America, 14-all, it's probably the bet out of all of those. I do find it hard to make a strong case for Europe. Say, Ryder Cup it's a bit like the Lions in a way, in that, like, on the Monday or Tuesday after, is it going to affect your mood whether Europe won or lost? What you kind of want is the drama. We're asking this question on Golf Weekly of, would you prefer Europe to win 18-10 or 19-9, or the USA to win with the final putt on the final green and all the drama that would go with that on the Sunday? And I think it was sort of split of, like, people want the Sunday singles.
Yeah, obviously.
That couple of hours where anything could happen.
But every so often you would like to just pummel the Yanks.
Well, they just pummeled the Yanks last time out, so...
But not in America. They've never done it in America, have they?
Not massive pummelings, no. Obviously, there was the Miracle in Medina, which was a singles final day pummeling of the Americans, but Europe have been very dominant. It's going to be interesting to see who he goes out first. I think John Rahm will be first out in the foursomes. He feels like the sort of spiritual leader of this side.
Yeah,
I think Rory wanted to be that person,
but,
well, didn't 2016, you remember that match, like, probably the modern, like, the last 20 years of the Ryder Cup, the best moment was probably Rory Patrick Reed singles match. Like, the eighth green, Rory holds a 60-footer. You might remember, he's giving it the ears to the crowd. I can't hear you, I can't hear you. And then Patrick Reed rolls in like a 30-footer and is pointing at McIlroy. And now in the spirit of golf, they hug each other going off. But McIlroy, for three or four holes, is like as intense and emotional as you've ever seen him. Now, he loses the match, is the problem. But then at the last Ryder Cup in Paris, it really felt McIlroy was talking beforehand, you know, I want to be the leader. I'm the best player in the squad. I want to be the leader. And they put him out with Torbjörn Olsen, who's a rookie. I remember following him around that morning, and they played terrible golf.
Right.
They stunk the joint out to the extent where you were going, like,
sticking out with Sergio,
struggle,
right,
to pick Rory for the afternoon.
Right.
McIlroy was so off form, it seemed, but they stuck him with Poulter.
Right.
And suddenly Poulter was the one who was able to tap into the emotion, yeah, and Rory fed off that, but he couldn't transfer it for Olsen. So
that's interesting.
It'll be interesting to see how Harrington approaches that. And actually, I wouldn't be surprised if he put him out with Poulter or Garcia.
Lowry?
I don't think he'd play a Lowry. Now, he certainly, again, maybe it's a bit of mind games.
And Rahm? Lowry's not going to get...
Yeah, I think maybe Lowry and Westwood.
Okay. Well, look, we've got 3 days to speculate about that. So, because we're out of time here. Tuchel is in the green. Ever since Chelsea have got the new sponsor with a number on their shirt, that seems to be the reason that they're winning games 3-0 as a routine. It's like a perfect kind of little bit of branding for them.
That's poor. Remarkable turn of events. Themselves and Liverpool have had the exact same results every week of the season so far.
Really?
So Chelsea are top of the league because alphabetical order.
Right.
So exact same, goals scored, goals conceded, and obviously when they played each other, they had a draw.
Yeah.
And they've won the other games. So yeah, the exact same results. So far, they are inseparable right now. Yeah, Chelsea have a brilliant squad.
Well, we'll get to this because David Moyer's standing by, so there's no need for us to do too much more about this. But Chelsea are in the green. We could have put Liverpool in the green.
We could have, but I think you put Tuchel in because, like, Tottenham had done really well in the first half with the system that Nuno had implemented. They changed things. They brought in Lo Celso and Ndombele. Chelsea didn't seem quite ready for that. And then he reacts at half time, you know, brings on N'Golo Kante for Mason Mount. Mason Mount has been brilliant for the first few weeks of the season. But like, you're bringing on the best midfielder in the world, N'Golo Kante. Again.
Not bad.
You can give too much credit at times, but I think the way he turned around, they demolished Spurs in the second half.
If you want to win that Gillette starter pack, tell us who should be in what colour, red, amber or green. Get it to us by whatever means necessary before the end of the show and we will announce a winner. That is this week's Performance Rankings. David Myler's next.
OTBAN's Performance Rankings with Gillette.
OTB AM.
It's 6 minutes past eight. You're very welcome along to OTB AM. And we'd love to hear from you this morning. 0879 180 180 is the WhatsApp number. OTB AM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. David Myler, good morning to you. How are you?
Good morning, Jerry. You okay?
Yeah, pretty good. I said at the start of the show, that was a weekend where everything we thought we knew about the Premier League, we kind of all feel it even stronger after the weekend. Nobody's making us pause for thought. Man United have midfield problems. Liverpool are very good. Chelsea are very good. Maybe Arsenal aren't a complete spineless mess. That's the one thing that happened over the course of the weekend. But let's start with Chelsea, right? Because Nathan was just talking about them there. They've got a brilliant manager, a brilliant squad, and it's hard to see where the limit for their potential is at the moment. So, are they an unstoppable juggernaut? Is anything going to derail them?
Ooh. They just have serious momentum from winning the Champions League last year. They've just come back into the start of this season and they've just kicked right on like there was no break or no internationals, no Euros or nothing. Like you just see yesterday's game, Nathan touched on it there. It's not working for them first half. Like their midfield is getting like overrun. Tottenham had the run of the green, really. And then he just, you know, brings on Kante, brings off Mason Mount, and then they just get a foothold in the game and they just steamroll Tottenham. Tottenham never looked like they were going to get back into the game. You know, you looked at the Tottenham players, they looked deflated, they looked flat. There was no effort, endeavour from them. They weren't working for one another. But just at the same time, you have to give great credit to Tuchel for making that change, seeing that there was a problem. Like, bring on Kante, who's just controlling the game, winning the ball back. He spoke after about the intensity. He brought that to the midfield, his closing down, his interceptions, his winning the ball back, his positioning. And of course, then, not really something we, you know, really familiarise with Kante, but he gets the goal, albeit Jadis, a wicked deflection, but it was an incredible performance from him. But the thing is, last week, you know, during the Champions League, we're talking about Solskjaer, you know, getting his substitutions wrong. And then you look at Chelsea yesterday, someone like Tuchel was saying, this isn't working, this isn't right, we're not at our level, what can I do to change it? I bring Kante on, and oh and behold, they go and win the game 3-0.
He's making good players better as well. You look at that midfield of Kante, Jorginho and Kovacic, and everyone has raved about Kante for years, but there were a lot of question marks about Jorginho and Kovacic as to what their roles were, and Jorginho taking Kante's place as the holding midfielder and sort of been happy to just play the simple ball all the time. Like, he's been transformed into now, well, he is the European midfielder of the season. What has he done in midfield that has somehow brought the best out of all those?
Well, I think Jorginho is one of them. You either understand what his role is in the team or you don't. It goes back to when Sarri was in charge. Like, Jorginho is the type, he's not going to, you know, set the game on fire in terms of his play, but it's just his level of understanding of playing in the six. He brings an assertive control to the midfield that if you look at him, it might be 5 yards, you know, 5 yard passing backwards, sidewards or whatever. He dictates the pace of the game. He's very comfortable in possession. I wouldn't say that there's been a great uprise in his performances from when Sarri was there. And that's like obviously going back a few years ago. I think he's been very consistent in that because his style of play is a particular way. I think the biggest thing Tuchel has done is found a way to get them so organised out of possession that they don't give up spaces. Like the prime example of the game we always go back to is the Liverpool one. They go down to 10 men. But they never really look like conceding. Now, you could say that Liverpool's attacking options in that were poor. But Tuchel has brought something into Chelsea that makes them resilient. It's just so solid, the experience they have. Like, he brought Aspilicueta back in. Like, Thiago Silva, you look at his performance yesterday for, I think he's 37 next week. It was just phenomenal, his awareness. Now, I know you asked me about Chelsea's midfield, but I think it's a complete package what he's done. Like, he's made them so defensively solid. Since he took over, they've had the most clean sheets in the Premier League. Like, that's just, that stuff's incredible. And, you know, they say forwards win you games, defenders win you titles. And that's evident in his performance. And then when you've got players like Kante as well, it's just phenomenal. And, you know, you mentioned Kovacic. He's always been probably that driving force in midfield where he likes to pick up the ball and carry it a lot. He's a very neat and tidy player. But he's just found a way to get them all to click and all to gel that, look, Frank Lampard couldn't do.
I mean, look, the comparisons with Lampard are poor Lampard, obviously, because the team has exploded into one of the best teams in world football, and who knows how long they're going to be able to remain at the top. It looks like quite the while. The quality of the play that he's getting from the older players is something that you mentioned there. Like a lot of managers would have come in and discarded Aspilicueta, or, you know, obviously, did he sign Thiago, or was Thiago already there?
Thiago was already there.
But, like, you can see why, I'm going to build a team, I'm going to take some time, I'm going to make sure that I get, you know, that 18-month window that managers seem to get. But he was like, no, these players are really good. And Marcus Alonso even is somebody that you kind of felt like, well, maybe he won't suit a coach like Tuchel. That's a peculiar man management skill that isn't just the I'm a tactical nerd, I'm a kind of a bit of a genius who sees triangles where everybody else only sees 2D. Like, that's an underrated part, it seems, of his managerial talent.
Yeah, of course, because look, the first thing he did when he took over was he brought Aspilicueta back into the side. He reinstated him as captain, and he played, I believe off the top of my head, he's actually played the most games in Chelsea since Tuchel has come in. Now, Frank obviously had been at Chelsea, played with Aspilicueta, and obviously he managed them. I don't know what happened. Aspilicueta, I imagine anyone who's ever watched Chelsea play or ever watched any interview, Aspilicueta wouldn't really seem like a bad guy. I think he's a fella that you'd want, you know, in the trenches with you. You look at his performance yesterday, you touched on Marcus Alonso. They think that they signed Ben Chilwell for 50 plus million, and now he can't get into the side. And even Tuchel did an interview the other day where he said, like, Alonso didn't go on international duty, stayed, worked really hard. He's doing really well, and he deserves his spot on the side. Most managers would have probably gone back to Ben Chilwell, albeit he more or less had a tough year personally with England because he didn't feature much in the Euros. But in terms of, like, the way he's got them to bring in Aspilicueta, to bring in Alonso, and if you look at yesterday, second half especially, those two are bombing forward all the time. There was a great example of a ball getting crossed in where Aspilicueta keeps it alive. And it's Marcus Alonso who's having the shot in the goal. You know, it's just what he's done with Chelsea is incredible. And it's no disrespect to Frank Lampard as a manager, but he's taken them on 2-3 levels. You can see someone who has that experience of managing, you know, in big games, you know, big teams in Dortmund, PSG. He's learned his trade. He's got great experience, and he's found a way to get Chelsea going. And they're going to be very difficult to stop this season.
It must be a great thing for squad atmosphere as well to have a coach who is open-minded and willing to change his opinion, because Marcus Alonso was, I think, expected to leave the club maybe in the January transfer window, again, strongly linked with moves away during the summer because they had Ben Chilwell there. But he obviously saw enough of Alonso to want to keep him. Likewise, at the back, they were desperate to sign Koundé from Sevilla. There were question marks about Rudiger. There were question marks about Christensen. They didn't get that, but it doesn't seem to have impacted in any way on the confidence of the centre-halves.
No, it hasn't. And even if you look at it as well, he sold Kurt Zouma to West Ham. We've seen his performance against Manchester United. Like, he's made a couple of calls that, you know, some would question. Obviously, people who watch Chelsea all the time, or, you know, certainly their fan base would be looking, kind of going, well, I'm not sold on Rudiger. Alonso needs to move on. Do you know what I mean? Kurt Zouma is the one. Even Vakayo Tomori, if you remember when he came in under Frank, he did really well. He moved him on. He's made some really big calls at times, but they've all worked and they've all paid off. Like Chelsea, like I said, they look like a title-winning team. They look like they're, like, going to be very difficult to stop. They look like they're going to keep clean sheets. Obviously, they've gone and signed Lukaku fresh off winning Champions League. They look like they're going to create chances. We all know that Lukaku will score goals if he's given enough service. He's done wonderful things with them. And I any team I feel that finish above Chelsea will win the Premier League.
Next couple of weeks going to be absolutely massive as well, because Chelsea, Manchester City, Saturday, and then the following weekend, Liverpool, Manchester City.
And he's got the upper hand on Guardiola. You look at, you know, the FA Cup, the league games, everything last season. Do you know what I mean? He's kind of got Guardiola's card marked.
Yeah.
He kind of understands what he's doing, and, you know, he set them up All right, I believe they were both fresh off the Champions League game and they both rotated their squads in the first league game. But still, Tuchel knows he's found ways to beat that Manchester City side, so that will be a fascinating game.
Yeah, Pep needs to stop, I don't know.
Tinkering with everything.
Well, I don't want to reach for the cliche about overthinking stuff, but he should have put out a stronger team against Chelsea to get the record, to go, yeah, actually, we've beaten this club now, we understand it, it's no big deal. It's just, but now it seems like they're in his head a little bit. You mentioned there if any team finishes above them, right? So if you're sitting in the in Jurgen Klopp's office and Klopp is talking about Chelsea and their strengths, you know he's picking weaknesses. You know he's like, well, Thiago's quite old. Do they fully believe in Christensen? Why are they playing three at the back the whole time? What are those conversations that he's having about where the weakness in Chelsea, where the little crack is going to appear over the course of the next 30 games in the league that gives him hope?
Very, I suppose for me straight away, the first thing that you highlight with Chelsea would be you have to go after the left-hand side. Rudiger is, you know, he's a good defender. He's very quick, strong, but he's rash in a challenge. I think Marcus Alonso's positioning at times defensively is all over the place. I don't think he's a particularly great defender. And then you've got probably the most informed, well, one of the most informed players in the world in Mohamed Salah on that side. If it was, you know, Liverpool v Chelsea that you're hoping that go that way. So you're going to imagine that if, you know, Guardiola is looking at it, who am I going to play? Am I going to get someone like Riyad Mahrez over on that side? Or do I go with, you know, Bernardo Silva, etc., or someone that's going to work up and down? But I think like Alonso offers Chelsea a lot going forward. And he's very good. We've seen that year in, year out when he has played, that he scores goals, he gets himself into great positions. But there has always been massive question marks over his defending. So any team playing Chelsea, you're going to look to try and isolate those two on the left-hand side and try and get down there. And it is difficult because you've got three centre-halves then to cover for him. So if Rudiger does get pulled out of position, you know, Thiago Silva is that experienced, that clever, has that know-how to slide across. He's going to drag Christensen in with him. Aspilicueta wouldn't be as good, particularly going forward, but he's always been very reliable and he's a solid one-on-one defender. He'll tuck round. They've still inevitably got a back four in place, even if the wing-back gets caught out of position. That's the beauty of him and the way he has them organised and drilled, that they just shift nicely across in a line. And they're very, look, they're going to be very difficult to break down.
Cannot wait for these couple of games. Like, these are elite world football matches we're going to see over the next couple of weeks. I think Liverpool and Manchester City over the last 3-4 years brought it to a whole new level. Probably the best we've seen, if not better, since Arsenal Manchester United back in
Keane Vieira.
The Keane Vieira era. Like, we were lucky to cover an awful lot of those games. The speed of those matches and the technical ability you need to be able to pull things off was just as good as anywhere in the world. And now Chelsea, it feels, are part of that as well. So to have the three of them going head-to-head over the next couple of weeks, it could be already, particularly for Manchester City. Like, the next 2 weeks, if they were to go badly wrong...
If they lose them both.
If they were to lose them both. Like,
It'd be great for the story if they were to lose them both, because then they would have to come roaring back in the second half of the season. Just a quick word about Spurs before we move on, because... So Villa were beaten 3-0 by Chelsea last week, but they had the players who were quarantining, and so it wasn't the real Villa. You'd still be disappointed that they didn't put more up against Chelsea. You expect Spurs in the games against the top four not to roll over and have their belly tickled, because that's the whole point of having a league where you've got a $1 billion stadium and you've got one of the best players in the world, or a collection of players you've invested tens of hundreds of millions in over a period of time. But they were completely useless in the second half yesterday. How did that happen? How did they stand over that? How are they looking at themselves in training this week and going, yeah, we are professionals getting paid to do this?
That's a very difficult question. Like, you touched on there, right? They have got one of the best, you know, strikers in the world. He's not playing as a striker, is he? There's too much at times of him dropping way too deep. There was a prime example yesterday, if you remember, when Reguilón burst down the left wing, they had some nice play that came through in the defensive third. Harry Kane was 40 yards away from the goal. And you're kind of thinking, you're the man who's to get us the goals. You've done it year in, year out. Now, I know he's a wonderful range of passing. You know, the assists last season were off the charts for a striker, everything. But it's just, he seems fed up. I think, like, once once the kind of, you know, he'd come out and made his statement saying that he was staying, and I think, you know, the team started, and him obviously started really well in the Premier League, he's kind of come back in now as their mainstay, and it's just not working. He does look fed up. His body language is off. There's no getting away from that. He just looks like he wants out. I think he thought there was going to be something else for him, that the team were kind of moving in a good direction. I've seen some interviews where players are talking about Nuno and what he's bringing to the club, trying to bring that family atmosphere back, a bit like what they had under Pochettino. I think Harry Kane's head is just scrambled. I think he's just had enough. I think he's probably annoyed that he's not gotten the move. Maybe it was a case a bit similar to what Berbatov and Modric went through, where they were told, look, give us one more season, get us back into the Champions League, and we'll leave you go on your way. Who knows? But it's certainly worrying times for Tottenham, because Harry Kane isn't playing at Harry Kane's level. He is a top professional. We all know that. But yesterday, he looked miles off the pace. And then you have a problem if he's your main star, that could they have brought someone else on to replace him, just to say, like, come on, Harry, you know, you're not at it today. Are you going to get back to the level where these big clubs are willing to pay £100 million for you?
No one's paying £100 million at the moment for that, are they? Like, that's the thing. He's actually playing himself. I don't know. Maybe one of the clubs thinks they can rescue him and that this is a blip and he'll get back to his form. But, you know, how long can this continue?
Maybe it moves so quickly that it suits both Manchester City and Spurs for Harry Kane to make that move in January. City might be in desperate need by then, and Spurs may think, actually, yeah, that £120 million will do us just fine.
Okay,
you're still talking about 3.5 months, though.
Mm.
You know, like, it's Manchester City. We saw them last year. You know, started off really slow and then went on this incredible winning streak. That they, you know, Pep will trust the process. He won't panic. You know, obviously, get jumpy over games, certain games, if they play top six sides, he will be restless, but he'll trust the process to say, this is a long season, I know my team can come good. Like, Erling Haaland is available next season for half of £60 million. You know, that's the thing. And then you look at someone at his age, the amount of goals he's scoring, not only in the Bundesliga, the Champions League, that Pep might go, do you know what, I want this fella.
Yeah.
There's obviously that
the type of goals he's scoring.
Yeah,
it's my favourite Sunday night thing, is when someone tweets the 88th minute winner that Erling Haaland scores, and every one of them is different. The one last night where chips the keeper from the, or lobs it over the keeper from the edge of the area, and knows exactly what he's doing, sends it about 50 yards up into the air, so it bounces exactly on the line and in.
So it is an interesting one. And, like, look, Harry Kane, just he doesn't look at it. And we've seen enough people talking about how professional he is, everything, and I've heard the same stories, I've spoken to the same kinds of people. Like, he does look miles off it. That was just his performance second half yesterday was awful. Well, even in the first half too. For someone who is so good, has so much ability, you know what I mean? Someone who can get you goals in moments. You even seen him in the international break, the goal he scored, just gets the ball like 25, 30 yards out, you know, scores, whatever, you can talk about the keeper, but he's someone that can do things. He just doesn't look like he's... The biggest thing is you want to see players play, you know, with a smile on their face and they're happy and they're working for their teammates. There was none of that yesterday. None of that from him.
Do you think he's going to make things right at Spurs, or do you think it's at that point now where divorce is inevitable?
I think he'll make things right. I think the type of person he is, I think he will make things right. I think, yes, there would have been a good wake-up call for him. There's also at the same time, then he's probably looking at Chelsea kind of going like, you love the way Sky build up all the games. You go back to, you know, the Battle of the Bridge where Tottenham played Chelsea and Chelsea beat them and everybody handed the league. But there was that kind of, there was a passion and raw emotion in the game. Chelsea just yesterday turned up and, you know, certainly in the start of the second half, they just kind of went, well, we're Chelsea, we're better than you. I mean, we're a better team than you. We're more organised. We know what we're doing. And they just blew them apart second half. Like, first half, Tottenham got the rub of it. But then, like, we've said it 100 times here, that Tuchel makes a tactical change. It just felt that Chelsea are moving, you know, like an upward rise of Tottenham, that they're moving ahead of Tottenham and the Tottenham are just being left behind. And that was clearly evident in the second half. And you could tell the frustration, not only in Kane as well, there's other players as well. At Tottenham, I'm not going to say they're going to have serious problems, like, but the season, I feel, will end up petering away from them and they'll finish in, you know, 6th to 7th, when really you expect Tottenham, that they have very good players, they have a very good starting 11, that they could be trying to push the top four. The way it's going after yesterday, I'd see them just altering short and ending up, you know, just comfortably taking a Europa League place.
The Manchester United game yesterday, we had live commentary on it, and it felt like we've commentated on this Manchester United game about 20 times over the last year, where they start quite slowly, go a goal behind, suddenly they spark into life. They've just got so much attacking talent, someone is always going to get them back into the game, yet still can't control the match in the second half and sort of eke it out and show character. And you can't question that there's not a lot of character in this United side right now. But you're also left with the same questions about the middle of midfield. I'm just thinking, when you're talking about Marcus Alonso, is this where the difference in quality of coaching really comes home to roost for Manchester United? Because, like, Marcus Alonso is not the best left back in the world. Cesar Azpilicueta is not the best right back in the world. Yet, he's managed to get them as integral parts of his Chelsea team. And we look at Manchester United and all the focus is on, well, if they had a world-class central midfielder, they'd win the league. But they've 9-10 world-class players on that side. Surely good manager can come up with a system that that one area where you're missing that one player, you can somehow get by without them.
Well, every player United have is more or less 50 million in each position. There's no getting away from that. They have a team assembled of world-class players. You talk about their system. Obviously, he likes to play that kind of 4-2-1-3. He obviously likes to play the kind of 2-6s. You know, he went with Fred McTominay, who seems to be his go-to. I think McTominay adds the legs. I think that's why he's so important to that midfield. I think when people say, when people talk about a world-class number six, you know, obviously you've got Kante, who's the best in the world at it, in turning over possession, winning tackles, his interceptions, everything. You look at probably the performance of Declan Rice in the Europa League, certainly, you know, in the game against United. He brings a bit more to just the six. He's very good at winning the ball back, getting in great areas. He drives the team forward. And I don't think Manchester United's Fred or McTominay or Matic, Donny van de Beek, when he's played, they don't do that. And I think Declan was a prime example. He's the name, obviously, that's been touted, of course, to Manchester United. He does add a bit more. Like Fred, he's comfortable in possession. He wants to get it, keep it simple, keep it easy. McTominay tries his best to be that driving force in midfield. But I think it's kind of also a bit unfair in him, because when we look at Manchester United and we go back down over the years, and it's very hard to get away from it, but you look at the great midfielders they've had for the oldies like ourselves who remember Robson, then on to Keane and Scholes, Nicky Butt. They've always had phenomenal midfielders who can, you know, play that six. And that's kind of missing piece to their jigsaw. Like, they've got, you know, Sancho, Greenwood. They've got Ronaldo, who looks unstoppable. He's going to score goals. You've got still got Rashford to come back, you know, which is going to be huge. You've got, you know, Bruno and Pogba to provide. It's just you're looking for that safety blanket, that six who can sit there, mop up everything, who doesn't want, you know, who doesn't want to be, you know, back page of the newspaper for scoring 40-yard screamers. They just want to be in the team, doing the basics right, getting on the ball, turning over, you know, whenever the opposition is pressing you, you're comfortable in possession, but then at the same time, when the opposition have the ball, you're winning it back in good areas, you're keeping it simple, you're keeping your team taken over. You can, that player can afford, like, can afford to leave Pogba and Bruno do what they want, where they've said, do you know what, I've got this, I'm so good at what I do. And that's a big thing. And that will, if they could get that six, then that would be huge, because, you know, the back four then feel more confident because they're getting less balls, because the six is kind of half doing their job at the same time.
I know Damien Delaney would make the point that a six doesn't necessarily fix things completely because of the attributes of the back four, that he was making the point that even N'Golo Kante couldn't save Manchester United the way they're playing, that because of the lack of pace of Maguire, they don't want to play a high enough line. There's two big gaps. And we saw that yesterday. Like, it was bizarre the amount of times yesterday that West Ham broke and you're kind of going, where's the midfield? And it turned out actually McTominay and Fred were there. They were actually back behind the ball. None of the other four tried to get back. None of the other five tried to get back at all. But they had to play so deep because the defence was so deep, it left acres of space. That because United can't play a high line because of the lack of pace of Maguire, that a number six is going to be in a very difficult position.
Yeah, but I get what Damien's saying. I get where Damien's coming from. And, you know, if the centre-halves are dropping off once the opposition is in possession in, say, the middle third, and there isn't massive space between the midfield and the defenders, where a number 10, a creative player, can pop into those spaces, pick up the ball, get turned and drive straight. It's also the case that Manchester United back four will drop off because they're not as confident with the sixes that they're going to be able to turn over possession and win possession. That makes sense. If United were to sign a world-class number six, we don't know if the Manchester United back four will, you know, push up. I imagine Damien probably spoke about Van Dijk or Liverpool or something, because they're like, Liverpool squeeze the life out of it. They try and shorten a pitch. That's one of Jurgen's massive things. It's something they work on a lot in training, that they push right up in the team. Like, if you look at it at times, Alisson will be out by the D in the box. The back four will be on the halfway line. Manchester United mightn't feel as comfortable, that they'll think, do you know what? Let's just drop off, because the old saying in football is, if the ball is in front of you, you've done your job. So if Maguire and Varane drop off and they bring the fullbacks back, it also gives time to slow down the attack. Now, West Ham did it well enough where they looked to counterattack, and if you play at high speeds and you get good movement and, you know, good passing, good play, you can create problems if back four drop off. At the same time, if you push right up, you leave acres of space in behind you. It is a catch 22, and it is a difficult one. I feel if they were to add a six, like the one we always say is probably N'Golo Kante is the example. If they had N'Golo Kante, I feel the Manchester United back four would push up, and they would leave that space behind them. But it's hard to say, because unless they sign a world-class number six, we'll never know. But certainly in the case of you don't know if that's information they're receiving from the coaches that's saying, right, well, drop back off, give yourself space to assess the situation. Do we need to step in? Do we then just, you know, hold their line here and leave them come on to us, buy ourselves time so that the midfield and the forwards can get back?
The problem seems to be that we don't believe Solskjaer has that philosophy, because he's never articulated it. He's never told us that he's trying to get to this point, or he's never put his team out to play like that, even against sides who aren't very good.
But at the same time, Gerard, how many managers have all stated their philosophies?
Like, they don't need to, right? Most of them, though, because you watch them play. You watch Chelsea play. You watch Liverpool play. You watch Manchester City. You can see...
Okay, wait,
exactly.
I'd say all those three would happily bore you.
I'm sure
they
would bore
you,
but it feels fine. Watching United, that the plan is, and maybe it's a great plan, give the ball to one of the five brilliantly attacking players we have and let them score.
I agree with you, right? Chelsea, Liverpool, Manchester City and Leeds. Right? There's the four teams who all have managers that we know of. We know their philosophies. Now, can you tell me what Norwich's philosophy is, West Ham's philosophy is, Everton's philosophy? It's because they're the big teams. We see so much of them. They're managers with, you know, world-class players scattered on the team. Okay, Leeds, unfortunately, don't have world-class players. But that is Bielsa's style, which has been evident all the way back to his days at Newell's Boys. That's the way he's always played, with that intensity, that desire, that man-to-man system where we go after every player and we basically win by overrunning teams. The other teams, are like the big teams, we know their philosophy. The question is, what is Arteta's philosophy? It's easy to point to, you know, Guardiola, Tuchel and Klopp and say, well, that's obvious because, you know, all those managers have done it at previous clubs. Like, Pep is not going to change his style, no. Nor is Jurgen. You know, he did it at Dortmund, whatever. The thing is, it's Man United are probably still trying to find out their philosophy under Solskjaer. They've got a lot of fantastic players in different positions. And it's not a case of, you know, it even goes back to probably with Steven, with Ireland. He's trying to implement these styles, and it is difficult to turn over it in time. Now, there are other question marks with Manchester United that, you know, they're not a title winning team yet. They certainly have all the players, attributes and characteristics. But if United were to go up against Liverpool, Manchester City, Chelsea, you know, frequently, you'd feel that, you know, they would come up short. They have the players, but you would back the other three managers I've mentioned to tactically get it right against them if they were to play. And at the moment, United, like yesterday, you know, the result against West Ham, like one, after yesterday, it's great, Manchester United win. You know, during the week, there's a crisis. We're in free flow. It's all over the place. Solskjaer should be sacked and all this. And then, right, great win. Do you know what I mean? There's all the controversy with Mark Noble taking the penalty, Ronaldo and his penalty shouts. It's just so much. But... it's easy to point to those philosophies of the big clubs, because we know what they're doing.
Maybe he'll never have a philosophy. Like, maybe Solskjaer is the Carlo Ancelotti figure, and maybe it's the perfect figure for Manchester United right now, who knows how to handle big names, who can indulge Ronaldo just enough, Pogba just enough, and they all still seem very much on side with Solskjaer. You never hear anything from all the Paul Pogba rumblings about his future that he has any issue at all with Solskjaer, that maybe he doesn't have the philosophy, he doesn't have the deep tactical mind of those three, but he has an ability to bring attacking players together and let them play their best. And it does feel, watching how good they are, like they're going to win the vast majority of their games because of how good they are going forward, that they should be very close to winning a title this season.
I just feel that they will, when the push comes to shove in those really big games against the other top, you know, six sides, saw it against Villarreal in the Europa League, you know, that's where your question mark comes. That's where, can you get a team that organised, and can you win the big games? You know, the cup finals, whatever. That's where the question mark is. Like, look, you expect them to beat West Ham, really. You're going to expect them to beat the majority of teams. They've got look, Manchester United have got an incredible squad. And of course, they've signed one of the best players of all time, whose goal scoring record's off the chart. He just looks like he's going to score in every game he plays. But it's just, in the big games, you can't be relying on Ronaldo, you know, Sancho, Greenwood, Pogba, Bruno to create something that, you know, Ronaldo's going to score. There has to be more. And I think that's where they'll come short. I think that's going to be their biggest problem. But you touched on Solskjaer. I think after the Mourinho and Van Gaal situations, I think Solskjaer was probably the best appointment United could have gotten, because he's someone who knows the club, you know, who's been around it for years, understands this Manchester United way. He's got the backing of Sir Alex, who's probably still partway involved, and all the players feed off him. And I think that is a huge thing. And you look at the situation with Pogba, if we go back 12 to 18 months ago, that just like Raiola was out touting in the papers. I know he's been in the last week as well, speaking again. But I fully imagine Pogba would probably sign another contract to United because of what Solskjaer started. It's just now a case of, they probably need, or they will need eventually, a manager who's going to take them that extra 5-10% to go and win a Premier League title, to go and win the Champions League. I think that's where he'll come up short.
It's going to be a glorious soap opera in the meantime. There was one last thing I wanted to ask you about, because the Cork lads are doing all right at the moment at Sheffield United.
I know, I was there. I was there.
You were at it, right?
Yeah. I took my little girl to watch the game, and I said, oh, their daddy's friends are playing Connor and John. And next minute, Connor's whipping corners in and John's getting a free run. He's scoring headers. And I'm thinking, come on, John. But no, that's just the... I'm delighted to see the two of them doing well. I am. Like, of course, I was quite interested. I thought John might get a move in the summer. I thought there might be a couple of clubs, you know, sniffing around him. Because he's had, you know, he had a couple of decent seasons in the Premier League. And then obviously, you know, he's an international player. He's one of the first names on the team sheet for Ireland. Of course, look, I think Billy Sharp is captain, but more or less John is kind of captain because Billy doesn't play every game. Then Connor was a prime example. I played golf with Connor just before he moved to Sheffield United. And he was just saying, I just want to go and play. And if you go back to January when he left, he went on loan to Swansea. No, just I think there was a week in between him and his wife having a child. And he moves to Swansea, and like, you just think, like, fair play, because this fella is like desperate to play football, he's desperate to do well. And like I said before on this show, we want to see Irish players playing week in, week out, because it'll only benefit us. You look at Shane Duffy now, you know, he's in flying form, someone who looked like he was out in the wilderness. And then, you know, it's great to see Connor playing well. Of course, it was against Hull, who I still have an emotional connection with, but I'm happy to see them doing so well.
Yeah, I'm surprised Harahan didn't get more game time in the international fixtures. It felt as though they needed, particularly in the second game. I thought he was almost nearly being rested from the first match, for the match against Azerbaijan, that he didn't get a chance to make more of an impact. Because you say the second half of last season at Swansea, when he was playing that more advanced role, he was exceptional at times. But obviously,
maybe I was obviously Stephen and his staff's decision. Maybe it was his lack of game time at the time. I imagine once the next internationals come around, if he's playing week in, week out with Sheffield United, he'd definitely be putting his hand up to start. But that's part and parcel of football. You know, once you're in training, managers make calls on, you know, team selection, subs. They might have seen something. I know exactly what you're getting at with certainly with Connor's delivery from set pieces.
He should have been the team, yeah.
Except that short corner he took right at the end of the game.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I was at the game. Yeah, I can serve you, yeah. Oh. Yeah, Connor. Connor, when you're watching this back, don't ever do that again. give me a heart attack, yeah, when I just seen, was it about 8 Serbian players running up the pitch? Oh, my God, yeah. But look, that's one of them. That's one of them where it happens. He made a call to make a short corner. It didn't work out. And as you're sprinting back, you're like, please don't score. Please don't score. Please don't score. Please don't score. And lo and behold, they didn't score. But look, Connor just needs to be playing week in, week out. He'll be the first to admit that himself. And if he's playing, you know, puts him in a better mood, puts him in better form. He's getting up to speed. Like he did really well the other day against Hull, albeit Hull aren't doing particularly well. But at the same time, it's good. It's good for Connor. It's good for Irish football. And it's good to see him doing it.
Yeah, good stuff. David, brilliant. Thanks a million.
Cheers, gents.
David Moyner giving us his thoughts there this morning. OTBAM brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette, put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. If you missed that, you can subscribe to the OTB football stream on the OTB Sports app or wherever you get your podcasts, and we'll put that up as a separate podcast. Now, as Nathan mentioned, Brian Kerr was on live commentary for West Ham's defeat to Manchester United yesterday. Here he is paying tribute to the late, great Jimmy Greaves.
Earlier today, we have the sad news that one of the all-time great goal scorers, Jimmy Greaves, died at the age of 81. And I guess for a lot of younger people, he's part of almost a forgotten generation of football. When we talk about goal-scoring records, it's always Alan Shearer. Can Harry Kane catch Alan Shearer's Premier League record? Jimmy Greaves has more goals than all of them. The all-time top scorer in English top-flight history. John Giles, at every opportunity, brings him up when comparing him to even a Ronaldo, a Messi, in terms of how prolific he was. Your memories of watching him and how we should remember Jimmy Greaves.
Yeah, well, look, I think we have to respect John Giles' opinion because he played against him so frequently. He was in that era when Greaves was at the height of his brilliance. I mean, they'd be similar age. I mean, Greaves would be a bit older than John, but both in their prime at that time. So if he says it, you have to believe it. I can't say that I can judge that. But if you look at the sheer statistics, and I think his statistics over such a long period of time, 266 goals for Spurs, 366 top flight goals, 47 international goals, I think it was in about 57 international games. It's extraordinary figures at a time when the pitches were dreadful and defenders were allowed kick lumps out of forwards. A different era, of course, different era in terms of organisation of the defences and the numbers of defenders can be behind the ball. But still, you know, in the history of the game, in the history of the English game in particular, I think he was probably the outstanding goal scorer. I mean, you know, you can talk about Harry Kane now and Alan Shearer and Gary Lineker and other players from the past. Jeff Horst's numbers were brilliant. Bobby Smith, another Spurs player, I think he got 199 goals for Spurs. And go back to Dixie Dean, I think Dixie Dean's goals and numbers and ratio were just behind Jimmy Greaves. Charlie Buchan going back even further. But Greaves' goals to games return was extraordinary. He was a great player, great goal scorer. Wasn't a big man. Didn't score many, had the goals. He was fairly slight, but he could strengthen his body. He was a bit like Müller. He could turn defenders. There's your box. I did see him. I was at the World Cup in 1966. I saw the second and third games in the group when he got hurt against France, and that put him out of the rest of the games. I think he was fit for the final, but Alf Ramsey chose to go with the combination that had been successful in the semi-final with Horst, Peters and Hunt in the front part of the pitch, Bobby Charlton as well. So we missed out on that, and that was a massive disappointment for him. And he only got his medal a few years ago. I think he suffered with illness in recent years. He had a very good career in TV with Ian St. John. That immortal programme used to be on a Saturday preview it would have been Division 1, I think, at that time. Was it Premier League? I think it was even
Division
Premier
1,
League.
Yeah.
It was all Division 1. So, you know, he, by all accounts, and listening to people like David Platt talking to about him today, he was a great guy, a really decent guy, who was very popular. around the game for his humility and his personality and his ability to make people laugh. But his goal scoring was just extraordinary, and you know, he was a hero of mine. So I'm sad to hear that Jimmy Greaves passed today, and I'm delighted that I was around to see him playing. I didn't understand the game as well as I did as I got a bit older. But he was good. It didn't take much to understand how brilliant he was, the consistency of his goal scoring, the excellence of it, the precision of it, the way he passed the ball into the net, more than probably any other player that I've ever seen. He had the ability to pass the ball into the net rather than rocket shots into the net.
Brian, great stuff as always. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Nathan. Good day.
John Giles is going to join us just before 9 o'clock this morning to talk about Jimmy Greaves as well. It's 8:46 this morning here on OTBAM. Let me take you through the back and front pages of some of the sports sections and supplements this morning. Cristiano Ronaldo and Bruno Fernandes are developing symmetry. That was Brian Kerr talking about the chemistry that they have. Roy Keane slates Spurs' desire and ability with the basics after 3-0 Chelsea loss. And Griggs hails outrageous Bavin Parsons as Ireland get vital win as well. So that was the stories on otbsports.com this morning. I'm going to start with the Independent here. Mayo board slams personal attacks on players and coaches. So the Mayo County Board, PRO, issued a statement last night. Constructive criticism forms part of the narrative of our games. However, unfortunately, over the last few days, there's been a number of personal attacks on both players and team management that are completely unnecessary and unacceptable to all involved. Now, there has been speculation in Mayo, according to Colin Key's piece here, that the future roles of coaches Kieran McDonald and James Burke wasn't addressed in the statement. So there's no suggestion that they're no longer part of it, but there has certainly been strong rumours that they've stepped away or been their time is up.
Yeah, there were definitely reports in some of the local papers in Mayo last week that McDonald was done, but nothing has been confirmed as yet. It's definitely something from the outside people have been focusing on, the makeup of that backroom team. And have they got the very best people? You know, I said they had a lot of good, strong figures there over the last decade when you had Kieran Shannon, obviously Donny Buckley was in there, Keane O'Neill was in there, real coaches. And is that person there right now alongside James Horan, or is he bringing people in who maybe add to the atmosphere of the squad as much as question him and push him? So it'll be interesting to see if they do go, how he reacts. But after losing an All-Ireland like that, I guess you have to react. You can't just sit back and say everything was just fine. I don't want to say it was a strange statement, that maybe it's no harm to put an end on the season and get it out there. Like, I think the personal attacks seem fairly focused on, well, obviously Aidan O'Shea in particular. I don't know if he's talking about punditry there in terms of the criticism that came, or if it's the online sort of trolls. I don't think too many Mayo people have been that harsh on Aidan O'Shea. I'd imagine a lot of it's maybe coming from outside the county, but yeah, it's going to be an interesting winter.
The London Times, England's greatest goal scorer, Jimmy Greaves. That's the fact, isn't it? As opposed to the, Alan Shearer, you were talking with...
Yeah, you know, he scored 80 more goals in the English top flight. In fact, he'd scored more goals in the top five leagues in all of Europe until 2017.
I hadn't even
noticed that.
I hadn't either. Wow. He's sitting there having a fag in the dressing room afterwards, and the glowing tip of the cigarette.
2017, Cristiano Ronaldo surpassed him with most goals in
top
five leagues in Europe.
Right.
Because he went to AC Milan for sort of half a season. I think got 8-9 goals over there as well.
I didn't know that. The Irish Times, Tuchel hails unique and fantastic Kante. Moyes has no regrets over noble penalty call. We didn't talk about the penalty call. And then that is the winning feeling. Ireland get World Cup campaign back on track. Sam Monahan and Nicola Friday. And McGilley says Europe must rise above Kepka and DeChambeau feud or stoke it. What do you do? Do you like whisper darkly?
I don't.
What would Tyrone do?
I don't think you need to stoke it.
You can just stand back and let them tear
you
apart.
You have to assume it's pretty much an in-person Ryder Cup in that it's going to be full crowds, full media presence, and say every player has to do a press conference. Just let it play out. Just let the Americans answer all the questions. Just let them sit there awkwardly talking about what it's like being in a room with the two players at the same time. You know, Bryson and his giant ego, Brooks just wanting to have his naps but not being able to.
I can't have a nap. It's so bad. It's so life is so
horrible. And let it roll, because... You know, there's
people in that European dressing room who haven't had the best of relationship down the years as well, it must be remembered. Namely, the captain and one of the most experienced players in Potter Carrington and Sergio Garcia.
Yeah, yeah, fair enough. So they just talked about the Telegraph, right? That's the Telegraph there, a picture of farewell Greavesy. And then the headline is, a knight in all but name who was treated shoddily by establishment. It's like, why does that stuff matter? I have no idea. It doesn't make any sense to me. Jimmy Greaves has this amazing career, recovers from alcoholism, is beloved as a TV presenter, and it's like, he wasn't a knight.
Yeah, well, they're obviously obsessed with the honours list. It is a good reminder, and I know John Giles is coming up very shortly, that we're probably very lucky in this country to have a figure like John Giles to act as a sort of footballing historian and keep those names alive, because in England it feels there's 1992 and then there was a World Cup in 66, and unless you're on the pitch in the World Cup in 66, nothing else really mattered. So because Jimmy Greaves obviously missed the final through injury, despite being the greatest striker of his generation at the time, everyone remembers Jeff Hurst and nobody talks about Jimmy Greaves.
No. Two World Wars and one World Cup, isn't that how the chant goes? The front of the Examiner this morning, Rude Health. Chelsea, Liverpool, United locked atop of Premier League. Rudiger's an important member of the team.
Oh, up with a the alpha male goal. Of alpha males, by all accounts, in that Chelsea dressing room. He is the leader of that Chelsea side.
So he ain't getting out of it anytime soon. And then, sorry, Nature Gentleman paying tribute to charity campaigner Anto Finnegan. So Anto had been on the show and he passed away over the weekend. There's a picture of him there. Even an earthquake couldn't shake the unflappable Anto. That's a John Martin's piece paying tribute to the former Antrim footballer Anto Finnegan, raising money in very difficult circumstances but fighting the good fight till the very end. The back page of The Guardian, emotional send-off for scoring legend. Obviously, it helped. It was at Spurs, and then it kind of, you know.
Well, oh, Spurs against Chelsea, where, you know, he spent the vast majority of his career.
We're going to put a proper team effort in today, and the contrast with Harry Kane, like, no one's made it. Maybe it's too early. Maybe it's unseemly to draw the comparison with Harry Kane just yet. But maybe we'll ask John Giles to do it, maybe. The Daily Mail, Keane's blast, men against boys as Blues batter Spurs, and McIlroy insists he won't rise to American fans' bait. Every time Rory says he won't do something about the crowd.
No, like, if there's one thing that's been consistent of Rory's career, it's his flipping on things. By Saturday, it'll be, well, listen, just got to... A few of them are getting a bit rowdy. That side of it's going to be fascinating because it's sort of got a bit out of control post-COVID. The fan interaction with players, it's got more and more over the top. And the Ryder Cup, it's always been totally over the top. So God help the Europeans. The Solheim, there was no European fans at all. There'll be a few, you'd imagine. Plenty of Irish will manage to find a way in, but it'll be 99%.
De Hero, Solskjaer praises his spot-on Spanish star. So is David De Gea back now? Is that what we're saying? When David Moyle was talking about the teams who have a very definitive style of play, they trust their goalkeepers to be the player who is out on the edge of the D and pushing forward. Man United don't have that. They've got a shot stopper who is now back stopping shots. But that's what he is, right?
Yeah, he's...
So they can't play that.
He's not the... thoroughly modern goalkeeper that Ederson and Alisson are, and it means, you know, they don't have that ability to, he doesn't have that ability to play the sort of 50 yard pass. You see him try it sometimes it comes off, whereas with Liverpool and City, like, their entire game plan is based around the fact that we're happy to invite teams onto us, we're happy to play it around at the back, knowing that the goalkeeper can ping it probably 70-80 yards perfectly onto Mo Salah,
yeah,
or onto Gabriel Jesus, so, and it works every time.
It's not just a six they need, it's a new goalkeeper too. And
if, like, they want to play that, like, there's different ways of playing. There's no perfect way, so you can.
As we were making the point, what is Solskjaer trying to do? I don't know.
In a way, David's making the perfect point. The other three teams who are bidding for the title have maybe the best three coaches in world football right now. Manchester United don't, but what they do have is a squad that is as good, if not better, than the other squads. But look at what's happened from Lampard to Tuchel. Look what's happened with those same players at Chelsea. That was a brilliant Chelsea squad pre this. I know they've added Lukaku, but this was a brilliant Chelsea squad that he wasn't getting a song out of it at all. Tuchel has come in, put some noses out of joint. Like, you know, Reece James, England right back. Not getting a look in for Azpilicueta. Ben Chilwell, England left back. Nobody's raising any questions about this because they trust what the manager is doing. Would you have brought Mark Noble on yesterday?
I would not have brought Mark Noble on, but So you bring a goalkeeper on, the goalkeeper saves a penalty. You're a hero. Like, Moyes obviously sees them in training. I don't buy the whole he's not warmed up thing. Do you?
I don't think it's ideal. And it's just adding an extra layer of pressure onto an already very pressurised situation. It's pretty much the last kick of the game. They've missed a lot of penalties lately. Mikel Antonio's not on the pitch. You are up against David De Gea, who...
has never saved a penalty in his life, you know?
It's right. Like, when you think about it, like 7 years without saving a penalty when you're a goalkeeper. Seven years!
Totally the right thing to do.
How do you go that long without saving a penalty? But Noble just never, ever looked convincing when he came on at all. So clearly, everything I ever think about David Moyes goes back to a conversation with Mark Lawrence in about 6 months where obviously he knows him very well. He said, he's a worrier. Like, the one thing with David is he's a worrier. And it's just a... what's the right thing to do? Yeah. Overthinking it in the moment. Actually, just see Yarmolenko take the penalty.
I do feel bad for him, because if they'd managed to get Lingard, like, it's possible Lingard was doing that for him instead of to him, and he's just got one over on Man United, and it's some kind of redemption song for him.
Well, he's never beaten United since he left.
I mean, you know. And then for that to happen, I hope it doesn't. I hope it's not the start of something bad for them. The Brighton-Leicester game, at one point, live score flashed up the 2-2. I'm thinking, oh, poor Brighton have managed it. But then actually it ended up getting overturned, so they end up winning the game. Brighton, like, have, over the last 18 months, turned into a team who are playing really good football and are finally scoring the goals. Their XG last season was the thing.
Exactly. The XG last season suggested they were missing a lot of chances, and we know one of their strikers who unfortunately has a high XG and misses a lot of chances. And to bring it back to Irish football again, Chris Hughton, Brighton manager, people say, why did they get rid of? Oh, Graham Potter comes in. Oh, is the football that much better? It's not really much better. And they're finishing pretty much in the exact same place in the table. Talk to Brighton supporters. They love Chris Hughton as a man, but they were sick of the style of football, and every one of them was loving what Graham Potter was doing.
Yeah.
And now they're taking their chances. So you would expect that they'll kick on and that they should have a top half of the season finish, which would be pretty outstanding and probably puts Graham Potter in the mix for some of those big jobs over the next couple of years.
Like the Ireland job, maybe.
Like, unfortunately, the Ireland job is a step down from the Brighton
job. I was joking, obviously. But that's immediately the speculation started. Even though Kenny Cunningham in studio was saying... an hour before Chris Hughton got sacked, he was like, no, I don't see Chris Hughton in the frame for the Ireland job. Even if he gets sacked, then he gets sacked. And he's like, I'm going to repeat what I said an hour ago. I still don't think he's in the frame for the Ireland job. But predictably, the papers were like, oh, this ratchets up the pressure on Stephen Kenny. I'm like, does it really? I mean, I don't actually know. Is Chris Hughton, he'll be in the frame as a former Irish international who has managerial experience whenever the Ireland job comes up next. But... is that part of your long-term succession planning? I don't know.
Well, the FA have spent a lot of time in the last 3-4 years in particular giving opportunities to former players and putting them into underage sides, giving them opportunities, and those players should all start emerging over the next few years. Maybe not quite ready for straight after Stephen Kenny, but well, depending on whether they extend his job. I think John O'Shea is somebody who will be right there in the reckoning, whether it's 3 months' time, 3 years' time. So, yeah, Chris Hughton, it does feel like it'll be a step back.
Right, it is 8:59. If you haven't heard already, OTB are taking on another duathlon. It's all brought to you by Whoop, the digital fitness and health coach that provides personalised sleep recovery and training insights. Check out whoop.com for more details and to chat through how training has been going. We've got Tommy joining us now. Tommy, how are you?
Morning, lads. How are we doing?
How's your Whoop?
Getting on well, I think. Yesterday I put in a decent session after a few days of recovery. It seems to be working well. It tells you what you should already be feeling. I knew my body wasn't in a good enough place to go for a run until about Sunday, and I got through it unscathed yesterday, so I was happy with that. How are you finding it?
You're an athlete though, Tommy. That's
sorry. What's happening here? Tommy just randomly appears on screen to tell us all how fit he is of a Monday morning.
I'm absolutely not fit, Nathan. I'll put it that way. I've been struggling for my fitness over the last few months, injury wise, but the Whoop is definitely helping me get back on the road to recovery.
So we have a little OTB Whoop group where myself, Jer, Tommy, Adrian, Ashling are part of it. But also Ronan
Shane
Jones.
Shane Hannon should be there.
Shane Hannon should be there. But Ronan Jones, who was on the show last week from Whoop, and also a Meath footballer.
Yeah,
and all I'm obsessed with so far is comparing wannabe Meath footballer Tommy Rooney with actual Meath footballer Ronan Jones, and see how the two stack up, and see how close Tommy actually is to that elite fitness levels. And I'm sure Tommy is even more obsessed with it than I am.
I was at the start until I realised that the strain does not correlate with your fitness. If you're putting it, if you're seeing the strain, your strain is high, it means that you aren't necessarily as fit. It means your body's working really hard. You're trying really hard.
It means you're putting the work in, though, Tommy. That's what it means.
You're putting the work in, but you may not be as fit. So, like Ronan Jones is in the middle of championship right now. I'm not playing championship anymore. We're out in Meath Hill. So I think Ronan Jones and the Boyne are into a championship quarterfinal at this stage. Ashton O'Reilly's championship has just kicked off. You can see her strain is up there as well. I'm next. I'm still taking away. And then you can see the lads there. Golf. Nathan's strain has come from golf. Do you get a lot of strain from golf? Like, are you putting in a bit of a workout there?
Well, Tommy, don't mention the war. Poor Nathan, still concussed, still having a few flashbacks from the last time he played golf. He had to wear makeup for about 5 weeks to cover the shiner that he got the last time he was playing golf.
Never happened. Turns out golf, you lose a lot of calories playing golf. You know, you're out walking at a reasonably moderate pace, searching for balls for a good 4.5-5 hours.
Yeah.
Don't you mock me.
I'm not mocking. Jerry, we have 3 or 4 weeks left. You said last week you were starting your training.
We don't have 3 or 4 weeks left.
It's, what is it, 20 days less?
Yeah, it's less. It's the 10th.
19 days.
Is it the 9th or the 10th of October? It's that weekend anyway. So we have this full week, next full week, and then the taper down week where I'll be like desperately trying to see if a full week of rest and going to bed early can help me. So,
well, last summer when we did duathlon, I think it was the first time I properly realised how difficult it was to run after being on the bike. So I tried that yesterday. I tried to ease myself in. I went for a short 5 kilometer cycle and a 2.5 kilometer run, and my legs were in bits for that little run. So I'd get on it, boys, if I were you.
Don't you worry about us, Tommy. You concentrate on Ronan Jones there and upping things for yourself.
I'm glad that we're going to be in a contained area. We're doing it at Punchestown, so you're never that far away from medical attention if it's required.
Is it at the race course? I'll be having flashbacks to oxygen and 4 o'clock in the morning and areas I've previously been.
Well, the only thing is that you would have been able to recover back then because you were a young man. You were on stage in oxygen.
Yeah, I think it was in Ferry House then.
Was it? Okay.
Well, look, my recovery is 95% since last night, so I hope yours is up as well 95%? And you can put in a hard day of training today.
Oof. Yeah. So you did nothing yesterday, basically?
No, I actually trained quite well and I went for a little hike.
And you still got 95%? I'm 79%. Didn't get a great night's sleep, though.
It's not just the sleep, Nathan. It's the recovery around it.
I understand all that, but I'm just pointing out to him I didn't get a great night's sleep. That these are the things you don't have to contend with as a young man. You know, myself and Jerry are responsible for more people than just ourselves.
Yeah, Tommy. You have a dog. It doesn't count.
Yeah, does not count.
No, he's asleep now, so I won't wake him up.
Let sleeping dogs lie, as they say. Okay, so you're, on the basis of this, predicting that you're going to absolutely crush all of us. I see what you're doing. You're subtly flexing. I'm surprised you didn't pull a full Conn Kilpatrick here and just, I've got to take off my whole top here as the All-Ireland final is over, just to show the whole country who I am.
Tommy's sadly, Cristiano Ronaldo, and we're Harry Kane.
Sadly, I'm not that person. Sadly, I'm not. So thankfully for all of you and thankfully for everyone else, I will not be whipping off my top today and I'd have nothing to show for it. So, no, lads, I'm struggling. I'd be worried now. I've struggled over the last couple of weeks with various injuries, so I'm falling apart at the age of 28. So if I can get through this duathlon, I'd be very, very happy.
And have you given up? I mean, you saw what Pádraig Ó Hoare was able to do at the age of 28 this year. Have you given up, Andy McEntee, the call's not coming?
Well, listen, when I didn't get a call last winter, I said that might be it now for my inter-county career. So yeah, I think that's it, lads. I'm not going to retire. I'm not going to release a statement or anything like that, but I think that might be it.
Why don't you transfer down to Clare?
I don't know, lads. I think I'm better off just putting a pin in it and finding a new dream, and maybe something like endurance sports might be the way to go.
We have unleashed a beast.
Mm.
All right.
Let's see what happens.
Tommy, good stuff.
Thanks, lads. Best of luck. you need to get your training in.
You seem worried about it, though. Sorry, that's the last point of...
I am a little worried. I just feel like it's creeping up on you, and you kind of think you've got this lovely new tech. You're like, I've got the Whoop. It's going to be fine. But you got to put the work in around the Whoop, lads, for the Whoop to work for you.
I had 5.5 hours sleep last night.
Okay, well then get on that sleep and then Tuesday, put in a good day Tuesday.
Right. As Tommy has told you, we're taking on another duathlon. It's all brought to you by Whoop, the digital fitness and health coach that provides personalised sleep recovery and training insights. Check out whoop.com for more details. And please don't join our group. Do people have to request to join our group?
I hope so. The shame.
I think it's a private group.
Is it? Okay, you're still there. Yeah, it could. Yeah. It's like, because it should remain private. I'm like, oh my God. I'm the bottom of every category. It's like, how do I fix that? I don't really know how.
Put the Whoop on somebody else.
I mean, yeah.
On one of the kids. Tearing around, driving you mad.
That might be the only way out of this. It's 9:05. We'll take a quick break. OTBM is brought to you by Gillette. Good mornings. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors.
OTB AM.
Shifty lad's been in touch to say respect for Owen and respect for Poch. Maybe he wants out of Paris Saint-Germain. The easiest way of getting let go is to give Messi the hook. I mean, it's a bit early for him to be wanting out. You want to at least kind of get to the point where they have to pay some compensation. Fergus Keogh says Mark Noble in the red. I mean, he had one job.
It's true.
It was those penalties that everybody says it's the perfect height for the keeper, and it was the perfect height for the keeper.
There wasn't enough pace on it. Like, that's the key to a great penalty taker, I think, is how hard you hit it. Harry Kane, keeper guesses right half the time, but he puts so much pace on it and it's so low and quick into the corner, you can't stop it, where, as you say, once De Gea dived the right way, he was always going to save it. But Mark Noble.
You nailed the nationality thing. If this was anyone else, they'd get slaughtered, says Ryan Bevan about Harry Kane. I do think that Harry Kane has like a 24 or 48 hour window now, because a national hero has passed away in England, that the criticism of him will be less pronounced.
It was Chelsea as well. So we're talking about a very, very good team who were tactically set up in the right way that probably impacted on the ability of Kane to influence the game. But it's just his body language. Body language was shocking. Just doesn't look interested. And he did try and force through a move. We shouldn't forget that like, he is there under duress. He's made it clear he didn't want to be there. We don't know why that move broke down. Really, was it that City just were unwilling to pay that extra 20 million to get it, or did they lose a bit of interest at one stage? Did they think they were going to get Cristiano Ronaldo? Did agents are involved? Harry's brother's in there with the big guys.
Yeah, that whole thing about sitting at the card table, if you can't find the sucker, you're the one. And it feels like Harry Kane's agent in the past has ended up doing deals that have not been, it turns out, with the benefit of hindsight, the best, and not just hindsight, we said it at the time, it's a silly deal. OTBAM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning, start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors. We have plenty coming up on OTB Sports Radio today. I'll tell you about that. Let's talk briefly about the Ryder Cup and the situation that we have at the moment. This week, Harrington obviously was on Golf Weekly, very, very good with his time. Any specific takeaways?
Well, I think in terms of preparation, because of COVID, not able to go through the beginning of the week the way we'd want, it's going to be a slightly different week, even with regards to the Brooke Koepka interview, of the sort of sideshow and the gala dinners and all that sort of stuff. None of that is happening because of COVID. So basically the first time they'll be together is for the opening ceremony, when they'll announce the foursomes partnership. So there's none of the usual razzmatazz for the first 2 or 3 days. So it'll be a lot calmer, which I presume is probably why they're only travelling over today.
Sharon Viola, no getting her moment in the sun.
Well, there'll be somebody will get the opening ceremony.
That was the opening ceremony,
that was
it?
The opening ceremony. Right. So that will happen. So he wanted to bring Keith Barry out as part of the entertainment. I was asking, was it to hypnotise a couple of the bad putters and hope that things might come around, but he couldn't get a visa for him. So any of the people he wanted to bring over, couldn't get a visa for. In fact, the only people that are travelling with him are his wife Caroline and the two lads. So none of his extended family can travel over again.
They needed to get on to Joe Biden to sort that out.
On travel. So he had in his head, he said, that the Ryder Cup was going to be this big celebration of the end of COVID, and it's not quite the case. So maybe not what he would hope for on a personal level, having everybody that he wanted there around him. As I say, I think the underdog status is something they're really going to try and build on. Like, it is the European Tour, and the European Tour is very much the underdog against the PGA Tour. wasn't big on all national partnerships. Again, maybe mind games and trying to push people away from the Rory Lowry partnership. Could you put Rory and Lowry out first on Friday morning in the foursomes? I'm not sure either of them are playing quite well enough that he would want to do that right now. But said that all 11 players said they wanted to play Victor Hovland. That's how talented Victor Hovland is. Rookie on the Ryder Cup. Seems to have just brilliant attitude. He'll fit into the dressing room perfectly. So everyone keen. And that's why I think I wouldn't be at all surprised in the foursomes if it was John Rahm, world number one, and Victor Hovland, the up-and-coming star of European golf, that's coming through. So he gave the examples that, you know, he played with Graham McDowell in 2008, but he didn't know Graham McDowell at all, and he was sort of put with McDowell because they were both Irish, but obviously came through such different backgrounds, different age. McDowell went off to college, so really had no idea about McDowell's game or anything, but was stuck in there with him. And likewise, played with McGinley at a stage, and their relationship had changed in that when they won the World Cup, it was perfect that McGinley was the leader of that World Cup winning team back in 97, and Harrington was happy for McGinley to be the leader. But by the time it came around to Ryder Cup, Harrington's career had surpassed McGinley, and then it meant there was this sort of awkwardness of, well, I've always deferred to Paul, but now I am the senior player, and how does that work? So he's definitely pushing away from the obvious, you'd have to assume, Rory-Shane partnership. Says he knows his foursomes pairings, by and large knows them.
What's he risking this week? What's the risk for being a captain who loses? And in the olden times, you'd get another go at it, right?
Like you would. That's definitely not going to happen. Rightly or wrongly, maybe shows as well in terms of the seriousness as a sporting event. Like if you really wanted to win it, you would go and say, "Well, Paul McGinley should have had another chance. He did." Everyone agrees to perfection, but like Lee Westwood, Ian Poulter, Luke Donald, all these guys wanted over the next few years and will probably get opportunities. Westwood more than likely in Italy in a couple of years' time.
Who gets it in Adair? When's Adair Manor?
Adair Manor is 6 years away, 2027. It's
Rory,
very hard.
Non-playing captain?
I think it'll be a bit too early for Rory.
G-Mac?
So you'll have Westwood will be in Italy, you would expect. I don't think he's a big enough name in America. Probably Poulter in 4 years' time in America, and then it might be McDowell. But again, there's so many players there. You'd have a McDowell, a Justin Rose.
Oh, yeah.
Sergio.
Oh, yeah.
Sergio at home. I don't think Sergio could be the captain in America because everything that's gone on previously with Tiger. So maybe Sergio, captain back in Adair Manor. He's got very strong links with Ireland, Irish Open winner, all of that. So that's probably, I think, probably how it'll go. What's at stake? Like Harrington pointed out in the interview, he said, you know, I've won three majors. Does even another major change my legacy? I think another major at 50 would probably change your legacy and certainly add to it and put you level on four. Does another tournament win? It doesn't change his legacy. Does this change his legacy? It depends on how you win or how you lose.
Like, yeah.
Jose Mario Lazabal, the miracle of Medina, all for Seve. Like, were you not doing it for Seve for the first 2 days when you were being absolutely hammered? But they turn it around on the Sunday. Like, and it becomes this historic story.
Yeah, well,
where it's a load of nonsense. So Jose Maria Lazabal was not a great captain, but they won, and it's everything in hindsight.
It was a load of nonsense.
And likewise, when you...
That's the thing about the Ryder Cup, is that everybody writes stuff afterwards.
Well, exactly. Yeah, so I think the bad captains were Darren Clarke and Nick Faldo, because they made bad errors. Faldo, right from the start, just his arrogance was never suited to being a captain. Like, his speech beforehand is, you know, historic in terms of how out of kilter it was, talking about, was it Harrington picking potatoes at one stage? Graham McDowell didn't know. Graham McDowell wasn't quite sure what country he was from. Brilliant to watch back. Take 10 minutes out of your time and watch Nick Faldo's speech. Harrington's been out in RTE in front of the auto queue practicing.
Right.
And the other one was Darren Clarke and the Danny Willett and his brother situation, where Danny Willett's brother wrote a blog and basically hammered all the Americans. And then he
that
dropped.
Didn't help.
But he overreacted. So the obvious thing is you say, listen, it's Danny Willett's
not
brother.
My brother's keeper, yeah.
He shouldn't have done it, but we've asked him to step away. But Danny Willett was down to play the first morning, and they changed it the night before to punish him because of it. And Europe went and lost that convincingly. Like, he massively overreacted. We did tell Harrington that we have Alan Lowry writing a blog for us all week on the inside.
Did he laugh? Not quite.
Never laughs at my jokes.
It's 15 minutes past 9 this morning. You're very welcome. If you just joined us, this is OTBM, Sports Breakfast Show from Off the Ball. Let's move on because yesterday the news came through that Jimmy Greaves had passed away. To reflect now on one of the truly great football careers in any generation, I'm delighted to say John Giles is with us. John, good morning to you. How are you?
Good morning, Jack. Okay, thank you. A bit sad about the news. Yeah.
In the past, when we've spoken to you about Greaves and the skill set that he had and the talent that he had, you were as effusive in your praise of him as you've been about absolutely anybody. So for a younger generation, John, what was so good and so special about him?
Well, first of all, he was a great goal scorer. I just see this morning, a total of 602 matches and he scored 420 goals. And this was at a time when young people watching the telly from years ago and they see the pitches that were very, very poor most of the time during the year when they got wet and rain and all the various things. And he did it under those conditions. So goodness knows what he would do now, Jared, if he was playing. But he was one of the greats, in my opinion, real greats.
John, your career has overlapped massively. When you think back to you starting out in the late 50s, early 60s, that was at a time when Jimmy Greaves was, you know, he scored 41 league goals in 40 matches for Chelsea. Was he, at that early age, was he seen as a superstar of English football? What were the conversations like around Jimmy Greaves in those very early days?
Well, I think people were still amazed in those days at what he was doing, Ger. I think he was only 17 when he got into the Chelsea team. Who were an ordinary side, you know. It wasn't as if they were making loads of goals for him when he was at a very, very young age. And, I mean, you could tell straight away what he was at the time he was doing it. I mean, it was remarkable the goals he scored for Chelsea. Remarkable, you know, before he went to Italy then and then came back to have a great career at Spurs. He was a great finisher. He had all the skills for it. He was very exceptionally quick, great dribbler, left-footed. He wasn't bad on his right side either. And quick and good control. Wouldn't see him much in the game, Nathan. You know, he wasn't a grafter by any means. But most players, when he was in the Spurs team, in the great Spurs team with Dave McKay and Danny Blanchflower and John White, they wouldn't be on to Jimmy about not working hard enough. It's a bit like Ronaldo in that way. He was a goal scorer. He wasn't a grafter by any means, but a great, great goal scorer. And these players that played with him would live with him. You know, they wouldn't be worried about him chasing back or not chasing back because they knew what he was going to do. He was one of the greats.
There's a perception that he was a tap-in merchant or, you know, played it kind of on the edge of the offside line. But actually, looking at videos, he could score every different type of goal. There are shots from outside the box. There are the bit where you mentioned him dribbling. He could beat a player. He could go near post. He could go far post. He could pretty much do everything. Maybe not the greatest header of a ball, but apart from that, absolutely everything else.
Now, he'd say he used to have a joke about himself heading the ball. He wasn't a very big fella. He wasn't a tall lad, a big, strong lad. Well, he was strong, but he was very, very quick. But he had great balance, Jer. You know, he could go past people. As you say, he could hit them from outside the box. Now, he didn't have a great shot all the time. I'd say that most of his goals were well inside the penalty area. He could see it coming, you know. He's like all the great goal scorers. But dribbling, he's great balance. He's very, very quick. Very, very quick and very, very smooth. In his control of the ball, because when he got through, he was, and like all great goal scorers, Jack, he seemed to have loads of time to stick the ball in the back of the net. I mean, one of my first experiences with Jimmy Greaves, he was in the first team at Chelsea before I got on the team at Manchester United, but I played against him in the cup final, semi-final of 70-62, and there was Danny Blanchflower, took a quick free kick, knocked it over the top of the Manchester United defence, and Greaves was through one-on-one with the goalkeeper. And I was running back. Now, I had no chance of catching him, but I could see everything. And when he was on the inside right position, got the ball in his level, and you could see, it looked like the goalkeeper, our goalkeeper, was outside the post. That's how he approached the ball, at the goal. And inside of his left foot, and all I could see was a big, empty goal and get inside of his left foot, strike at home, which is exactly what he did. And that's the sign of a great goal scorer. Is when you see a bad striker, they get through and the goalkeeper looks like a big joint. He never got it past him. He made it look like the goalkeeper was outside the post. He was brilliant on that. He had the control, he had the speed to get away to the defenders, and this knack, if you call it knack, of making the goal look a mile wide.
John, were you ever able to get a sense of what Greaves was like personality-wise?
No, I didn't really know him. I didn't really know him, Jerry. I did an interview with him one time when I'd finished playing and he'd finished playing when I went to West Brom. But he was a funny lad on the pitch. I remember one time playing at the White Hart Lane and the two of us went in to tackle and the referee gave us a free kick against him. And he said, F in hell, ref. He says, the first tackle I've won all season. And you give a free kick. He wasn't a tackler, you know. But I think he was quite funny with the lads. But he seemed to have a mentality, Jared, that if you win some, you lose some. You know, like a lot of strikers are like that. They don't get, the great strikers, if they miss a chance, they don't get upset about it. They don't get down on themselves. And that was his attitude, Jimmy. I've seen him miss a couple of chances, even playing against me. He'd miss a couple, wasn't many. He said, well, that's the game, you know. Some you win, some you lose. But the next chance you get, he'd put it in the back of the net.
It's from his own perspective and from his own career's perspective, it's unfortunate, really, that he wasn't part of that England team properly that wins the World Cup, that he's not on the field of play because of that team. Obviously, Bobby Charlton was the standout forward, but he was a far superior striker than the ones who actually ended up playing in that game. Is that correct?
Yes. I think what happened was they got off to a bad start in the World Cup in 66. And what happens with Jimmy, if Jimmy's not scoring goals, which was very seldom, as I said, he's not contributing. And England didn't play well, and that's when Alf Ramsey made the change, because Jimmy was dependent on getting a good service to score the goals. England didn't play well in the first couple of matches. He made a few changes, Alf Ramsey, and unfortunately, Jimmy was one of them, because they weren't dominating the games and they weren't getting chances. He wasn't missing any chances. He just wasn't getting any chances. So that's when Ramsey turned around. And Jimmy was very, very unfortunate to be in that situation, that the team didn't play well and he didn't get the chances at the time of the World Cup. Because he got back into the team immediately after the World Cup. Mm. Very unfortunate in that way.
That England squad had come to Dublin, I think it was a couple of years earlier, for a friendly, John. Jimmy Greaves scored in it. England won 3-1. Mm. I know you were playing in that match. Do you have any memories of it at Daly Mount?
We were well beaten, I remember that. And Jimmy scored all the time, you know, apart from that particular spell in the World Cup. But I remember being well beaten. I think Ramsey had just taken over, or one of his first matches anyway, at that time. At Daly Mount. But that was a bad old days from Ireland's point of view, Nathan, you know. That's when we had the selection committee. Ramsey was the first manager in England, as we know, that was allowed to pick the team and be in full charge. Like in Ireland, we had to wait another 8 years for that. Mm. So we were well beaten on the day.
He never won a league title, Jimmy Greaves, and you often talk about that era and like that Leeds team you were part of won titles, but also went so close in so many occasions, and it was a great Manchester United at the time, a great Liverpool side at the time. Was it simple as that, that Spurs during the 60s were good but maybe never got to great?
Well, they were great before that, you see, Nathan, before Jimmy came on the scene. You know, Spurs were the first team to win the double. I think it was in 1961 or 60, well, certainly 1961 or 62.
Yeah, and signed that summer.
Yeah, he signed after they won the double, and he won the cup. I think he won the cup twice. Might have won the European Cup, but it wasn't the best of times for Spurs in relation to the great team that they had before that. So all the more credit for Jimmy to score the amount of goals that he did, Nathan, because he wasn't in such a great team. You know, Leeds came along, Liverpool came along, Man United came along at that particular time. Actually, I don't think Spurs have won the league since 1961 or 62.
Yeah.
Was it
so Jimmy moved out? Yeah, they missed out in the double, and then they won the cup the next year.
Was it a wild thing for him to do to go from Chelsea to Italy at that stage? Because very few players made that trip to join an Italian club.
I think Jimmy was a home board as well,
right?
And I don't think he ever settled into the Italian situation. And I think they had a coach there. I can't remember his name, but he was supposed to be a real, real hard nut. And was on Jimmy's back all the time. You know, Jimmy hated it there. I think his wife hated it there. It didn't last very long. He went to Milan, didn't he?
Yeah.
He didn't last very long there. Although, if you look at his goal-scoring record, and he didn't get on with the coach, I think he scored, you know, 10 goals out from 15 or 16 matches. But he wasn't there. He was there a very, very short time. I think he hated the Italian discipline. Used to take the lads away for a lot of matches, and I mean, there were very few lads from from England or Ireland that made it in Italy. Liam Brady eventually, when he got there, but John Charles did as well. But Dennis Law couldn't settle there. Joe Beggar couldn't settle there. Jimmy Greaves couldn't settle there. I think Jimmy was a home board on it. I think his wife didn't like it either there.
He certainly had an amazing career when he came back. The last thing I just wanted to ask then, obviously he becomes very popular as a TV host, which is kind of seen as this very important moment in English football where it crosses over from just being football to entertainment, and everything that comes after that, obviously we know with the money that comes from satellite TV and all that kind of stuff, is the explosion of the league. Is that important, do you think? Is that actually part of his standing and the popularity that he has now, that you see this outpouring of grief for him?
Well, I think a lot of people enjoyed him on television, but I think it comes really from what he did on the pitch. He was very popular on the television with Ian St. John. I mean, to be fair, Jimmy was in those days. It was like lots of players that retired or had to retire in those days. Jimmy wasn't financially secure by any means. None of the players of that generation were, so he had to do something. And Jimmy, like when he went on television. Was a totally different character that people thought he was. I mean, Jimmy, when he was doing his best or having his great career in football, wasn't in the papers all that much. He wasn't very well known. He was a very private individual. So I think he needed to make a living. I don't think he ever was going to go into management. So, you know, he hit it off with Ian St. John and they became very popular, and they did it for a long time. But I think he needed to do that.
Yeah, no, fair enough. John, thanks a million for joining us today. Cheers.
Okay, Ger, thank you.
It's John Giles giving us his thoughts there, and he'll be back obviously with Nathan on Thursday evening. Now, this week is the European Week of Sport, which aims to promote sport and physical activity in all countries across Europe. This week is for everyone, regardless of age, background or fitness level. That's you, Nathan. With a focus on grassroots initiatives, the aim is to inspire Europeans to hashtag be active on a regular basis and create opportunities in people's everyday lives to exercise more. To celebrate all this week and off the ball from 7 o'clock, we're going to be giving away €100 Sport Ireland campus voucher every evening, as well as an overall prize, which includes a family coaching session with some former Olympians at the facility, as well as behind-the-scenes tour of the Sport Ireland campus and more. So be sure to tune in tonight for that. We're turning our attention now to the Irish women's national team. Karen Duggan is with us to talk to us about this. Karen, good morning to you. How are you?
Morning. I'm very well, thanks.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about where Vera Powell is at the moment in terms of the evolution of the team, the style of play and a culture of winning, because that's the bit that's missing. We've certainly heard her philosophy of football be explained over the last couple of seasons, and they've been close in big games and they've had some errors, individual errors, that have cost them the opportunity to qualify for tournaments. But at what point does the pressure start to ratchet up where she needs to start delivering results?
I think it has to start straight away once we get into the World Cup qualifiers. The Australia game is an interesting one again, because they are ranked so highly in the world compared to us. So again, the 7 defeats on the bounce have been to teams that are ranked higher than us. So the pressure isn't really mounting in the same way it would, say, on Stephen Kenny, who's had some bad results to some bad teams. Even though the away loss to Ukraine, they were still technically ranked ahead of us. But I thought, I don't know if you saw the article Mary Hannigan had in The Independent during the week, but she kind of said the fact that Northern Ireland went and comfortably beat the Ukraine, that's the damning thing when you look at the resources that Ireland have in comparison to Northern Ireland. So I thought that was really interesting and a really good point. In terms of her philosophy, she's talked about how the group is developing, and that's the word she keeps using, and they're at their best that she's seen them every campaign, but it still hasn't translated into results. And in order for us to actually start qualifying for these campaigns, we do need to start beating the teams that are ranked ahead of us. I'm not sure where we are in terms of her philosophy, because we haven't seen evidence of anything that has turned into results yet.
There was a real feel-good factor on the pitch around the side a couple of years back, where they were starting to get big crowds to the games, results were building momentum, all sort of leading up to that Ukraine game. And we've spoken to so many of the players since then, and the devastation of that defeat and missing out on the European Championship, it's almost beyond compare with talking to other players from matches 18 months on, still sits so deeply with them, the frustration of it. Is there a confidence building job as well there for Vera Powell? Because it does seem as though a lot of those players are struggling to get over the disappointment of missing out on next summer's finals.
Yeah, and that's why I actually think it would have been good if we'd gotten a friendly against a team ranked lower than us to get a win, to build a bit of momentum going into the World Cup qualifiers. The fact that we're still talking about the devastation of that shows how deeply it impacted the girls, because it was that chance. It was the chance to make history and be the first team that qualified for a major tournament. And they know that they should have done it. Looking at Ukraine, they were quite limited when we actually played against them. They didn't actually create that much. And then again, it was shown how poor they were against Northern Ireland. No, not taken away from Northern Ireland, but they played really well. But a team of Northern Ireland stature, who are ranked possibly, I think maybe 17 places below us again, for them to win that easily really shows that should have been the time for them to grasp it. And it hits harder because it was a European qualification campaign and we're going into a World Cup qualification campaign, and we've got Sweden in our group. They're ranked second in the world. You know, they're most likely going to walk their way through it. Then we've got Finland, who are ranked 25th, and they're the team we need to be targeting. And the fact that we couldn't beat Ukraine, who were just a couple of places below us, that might stick in the girls' heads. So then you're thinking, okay, is it realistic for the World Cup, or do we have to wait until the next European campaign? And a lot of those girls again will be getting older, and maybe do we need to look at rebuilding in the same way that men's does? So it just threw up a lot of questions, and I think that's why it's so deeply like ingrained in everyone's brain still.
Yeah, so Australia is not what we need to see riding into town tomorrow night. That's there's a strong possibility this team is going to beat us.
There is, of course, if they put out their big team, they've got household names, like Sam Kerr. I think she'll be trying to close in on 50 goals for her country pretty soon. And Katie will have, I think, probably three of her Arsenal teammates there as well. They're a very, very strong team. But then again, it could have the flip effect. Say we play really well against them. Say we get back to basics and stop conceding goals. We've obviously been conceding a lot of goals to lose seven games on the bounce. So if we get back to basics, and even if it's just a park the bus job and it's not pretty, that's the preparation that they probably do need for the Sweden match. If they can get a result in that first game against Sweden, it blows the World Cup campaign wide open for them. And again, that would be the confidence boost. But like you say, the likelihood is that it could be a defeat. Australia, just off the back of, you know, a really successful Olympic campaign, so they'll be wanting to push on from there as well. So it could be a difficult night, but if they can get it right and they can hold off the likes of Sam Kerr and get a positive result, who knows what that could do for them going into the World Cup campaign.
We obviously saw the big announcement with a new sponsor in Sky, who obviously are going to invest a significant amount of money in the women's national team and in women's football, and there's a hope that transfers down to the grassroots as well. And it's an opportunity for the FAI to talk about the women's game separately from the men's game. Even the fact that there's going to be a separate shirt, I think, is going to be important into the future. You know, like we saw the Meath women's Gaelic football team have the best GAA shirt of the summer. There's a possibility there to actually rally people behind the women's team as a separate entity. What's your sense of where the team is at the moment and where the sport is in Ireland at the moment?
I think the talent is there on the team. I just haven't seen it quite click yet. I don't know if that's because there's been a lot of chopping and changing in squads and Vera's trying to find new players, and we'll see new players again. We don't really have consistency within the team. We've been changing formation and stuff. So whatever she does in this campaign or whatever she does against Australia, I'd like to see her translate into the campaign and for us to have an identity within the team, because I do think we have the players. In terms of where it is in the country, I think that there's like great participation rates, there's all that, but in terms of really taking the next step and building for a successful national team, I'm not sure we're quite there yet. We have the Women's National League, but outside of that, we still have big drop-off rates. I've spoken about it before, maybe the 19 to 23 age group. There needs to be something to kind of plug that gap and help girls along who aren't ready to go professional at a very young age. Girls develop at a different time to boys. That needs to be taken account of. And like you say, they have the opportunity now to look at the girls as a separate entity and build it from the ground up. It's a lot easier, I think, for the women's game to catch up to where we want to be than the men's game. I don't think it needs to be a complete overhaul. I think small changes will make a difference, more and more home-based sessions. I keep harping on about it, but I think that those development squads are so important. And when you look at Northern Ireland, they have a lot of home-based players, but they are together all the time. They know each other really well. And even if it's only four or five of those girls going in with the professionals, that they're not, there's not a big of a gap between them and the professionals when they go into camp, and it's easier to gel and it's easier to just work on tactics and an identity within the team there. So I think it's just about more and more training and offering that on the ground, because clubs can only do so much. Like I said, they're all voluntary, and as long as they're going to stay amateur and the FAI can't do anything about that, then what they need to do is look at providing other outlets for the girls to train.
There's always a lot in every Vera Powell interview, but reading between the lines last week, she doesn't seem totally satisfied with the quality of the Women's League of Ireland and what it's providing for the players in the international setup. She obviously has the international squad playing against men's teams and boys' teams, because she feels that is a step forward towards progression, and talking about some of the mistakes that were made in the last campaign that came from the home-based players, that maybe they weren't used to the pace of the international game compared to those abroad. Look, there's clearly quality there, with Katie McCabe was in the WSL team of the season. Denise Sullivan is probably the most talented Irish player there is right now. Is there a big differential in terms of quality within the squad from the very best to maybe player 25, 26, 27 in that squad?
I think that that's slightly unfair on the girls who are playing League of Ireland, especially because a lot of them are young girls who are getting to the point where they could go professional. I don't think the team as a whole gelled, and the majority of those were professional, so I wouldn't like to hear that comment reappear again, because the girls are doing their best. What I would say on that is, if she feels that that's not the case and the girls aren't getting enough training, it's not good enough to just say, go and find a boys team to train with. I would like to see her help put those structures in place, put more home-based sessions on. Colin Bell, for all the maybe negative some people had, maybe myself even included in that, he was very dedicated to getting home-based training and plugging that gap and making sure there was more training. So if you're going to be saying comments like that, I'd really like more help for the girls if she thinks that there is a big gap. I don't feel that, because I think our league isn't as far away from maybe WSL2, where we have a good few girls, and maybe Scotland. The only difference is that they are just training more, and that's the difference between our league and their league, is just that little bit of sharpness that comes from having an extra couple of training sessions a week. So that's probably an easy fix to stem that gap and get the girls ready for the step up. And I'd like to see her more involved in that if she's going to talk in that way about the Women's National League.
Because I think there was a home-based session, was there, a couple of weeks back, but it was because they thought at the time they were going to be playing Georgia and the English teams may not release the players, so she might have had to pick a totally home-based squad.
Yeah, so the home-based sessions that have taken place this year have tended to coincide when there is a camp and when maybe Vera is in town, you know. It's not been as consistent as it could be. And obviously there's COVID and there's other considerations that come with that, but when we do have this investment coming into the game, some of that has to funnel down into the grassroots development. It's not just all for the senior team, and if it is for the senior team, there's a lot of factors there you do need to help out within the Irish League. I think all the girls who have gone professional have done excellently, but we, if they want everyone professional, you need to help people get there and make sure that they're ready, so that they, when they are going abroad, they're going and they're starting for their teams. Because I think that, similar to the men's team, we had girls who were away who possibly weren't starting for their professional clubs. And as much as the training is brilliant, you can't beat that match fitness and the sharpness that comes with that, and the confidence that comes with that. I think even if people did need a confidence boost after some of those results in the last campaign, and unless you're playing, you can't really get over that, and the Ukraine game will stick in your head, or the Greece game will stick in your head, because that's the last time you've played 90 minutes. So there's a lot of factors in there. Yeah,
that makes a lot of sense. More training sessions would definitely help. Karen, good stuff, thanks a million for joining us. Cheers.
Thanks so much.
It's Karen Duggan, giving us some brilliant insight there into the situation as it stands at the moment, and that game obviously against Australia tomorrow night. OTBAM brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette, put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Tomorrow morning, football with All-Ireland winners Conor Myler and Vicky Wall. Author Paul Howard will join us to chat to us about his new book.
OTB AM
with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.